You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Sarah Stewart is the person who has discovered the cancer-causing virus in the first place. She is the world expert on it. And in 1960, right when they're starting this, she transfers from the National Institute to the National Public Health Service. I mean, an odd career move, except for the fact that it puts her in control of the facility in New Orleans where they're mutating the monkey viruses trying to develop an anti-cancer vaccine. And, you know, they all think they're going to win, you know, and come out with an anti-cancer vaccine that could be used to stop the cancer epidemic from the polio vaccine. But when this thing happens in 62 with the Russian missiles, it changes the whole complexion of the thing. And what happens is they start working on, they say, we're going to use the radiation to make this stuff more powerful rather than benign. And instead of making a vaccine, we're going to make a biological weapon that we can inject into somebody like Fidel Castro, and he will die and he'll never be blamed on us, because as we all know, you can't give anybody cancer.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Edward T. Haslam. Today's show, Dr. Mary's Monkey, Part 1. Edward Haslam is an author and researcher. He spent the first 35 years of his life in New Orleans. His father was a surgeon and taught at the Tulane Medical School, where he was a colleague of Dr. Mary Sherman, a pathologist, orthopedic surgeon, and one of the top cancer researchers in America. Ed Haslam personally heard and saw things that involved the investigation into the Kennedy assassination, the murder of one of his father's colleagues, and claims of biological weapons to be used for political purposes. In 1969, he commented that if there is a bizarre global epidemic involving cancer and monkey virus, 30 years from now, at least we'll know where it came from. In the 1980s, he stumbled upon hard evidence connecting people involved in the JFK assassination investigation to the medical community in New Orleans. He is the author of Dr. Mary's Monkey. Edward Haslam, welcome.
Thank you very much, Bonnie. Good to be here.
Well, first of all, I would like to congratulate you on a terrific book. Just absolutely terrific. I could not put it down. July 21st, 2014 marks the 50th anniversary of the murder of Dr. Mary Sherman and the publication of the updated edition of your blockbuster book, Dr. Mary's Monkey. In the prologue to your new edition of Dr. Mary's Monkey, you write that the death of this one woman unravels much of our nation's secret history. This one murder helps us understand why we have been lied to with such conviction for so many years. You say that writing this book was difficult, stressful, and dangerous. Quoting from your book, that what began as an investigation into the single murder morphed into consideration of epidemics which killed millions of people and which cost billions of dollars. It unveils the contamination of hundreds of millions of doses of the polio vaccine with dozens of monkey viruses. It spotlights the epidemic of soft tissue cancers that swept our country. It became an investigation into an underground medical laboratory that was accidentally discovered during an investigation into the JFK assassination, a laboratory which secretly irradiated cancer-causing monkey viruses to develop a biological weapon. You write that this story has followed you throughout your life. You grew up and lived as an adult in New Orleans, Louisiana. Please explain how the mystery surrounding the murder of Dr. Mary Sherman on July 21st, 1964, and events surrounding her death have haunted you since childhood. Wasn't your father a colleague of Dr. Sherman's?
Yes, Dr. Sherman. Dr. Mary Sherman was a orthopedic surgeon, and she taught at Tulane Medical School in New Orleans, and she ran a cancer laboratory for Dr. Alton Ochsner at his clinic, the Ochsner Clinic, which is one of the big regional medical clinics in the country. It happens to be in New Orleans. And my father also taught orthopedic surgery at Tulane Medical School. So Mary Sherman and my father were both friends and colleagues. My father was out of Harvard Medical School in the Navy, and Mary Sherman was out of the University of Chicago. And my father had, like, the utmost respect for this woman. I mean, he was pretty much in awe of her. Within the structure of orthopedic surgeons in the country, Mary was the chair of the pathology committee of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, which made her one of the highest-ranking women in American medicine. She was also widely published in three fields, one being cancer. She was an expert in bone cancers, and when the University of Texas went to write some release a book on tumors of the bone and soft tissue, they had several articles by her in there where she even challenged the language of cancer and suggested that everything needed to be renamed in order to make some kind of sense out of it all. Further, she was also widely published in the area of radiation. She was one of the people bringing radiation into medicine. And up at the University of Chicago, where much of this radiation stuff starts, I mean, that's where you have the first sustained nuclear reaction with Enrico Fermi and stuff. She was actually working with Enrico Fermi up there and was very close to him. And you have the others up there, Harold Urey and Zioid and those guys that started nuclear power. And so Mary Sherman had amazing connections. She was highly respected internationally as well as nationally. And so when she was murdered in 1964, it was big news in our family. I mean, Mary occasionally came out to the house. I remember sitting on her lap once as a child. And so I wound up hearing things through the grapevine that the public didn't hear. I mean, my father, for example, was asked to go take a look at the body in the morgue for a second opinion on the burns of what happened to her. And my father told my mother, and my mother eventually told me what really happened to Mary Sherman. But what the public was told was that an intruder broke into Mary Sherman's house and, in an act of violence, stabbed her 7 or 8 times and then set her naked body on fire. And so it was all pretty sensational stuff. And there were a lot of uncharitable rumors going around. And I heard from my mother that Mary Sherman's right arm was missing. And that was pretty strange, and nobody else that I knew of knew about it. And 30 years after all this happened, I went down to the public library, and I was able to get the police reports, the autopsy reports, the homicide reports on it, and all of the published press coverage, the newspaper articles about the fold for 2 weeks. And I read everything, and it was only then, as I had it spread out on my kitchen table, that I started to realize where the problem was. The problem was that the public was never told Mary Sherman's right arm was missing. This is the main fact in the case. I mean, this is like not mentioning that Nicole Simpson's throat got cut. So why wasn't the public told about this? And even in the last paragraph of the last newspaper article that appeared at the end of the 2 weeks said, oh, yes, this fire, the mattress fire smoldered for some time and burned away some of the flesh from the doctor's right arm. Well, this is not a question of burning away some of the flesh. I have the photo up on my website, and it's now in the back of the book, the new edition, the hardcover edition of the book. And you can see that Mary Sherman's right arm has been disintegrated by heat. It is gone, as is her rib cage, and you can stand there and see the internal organs of her body. Then you look at the photograph, the crime scene photo, with the detectives in the room, and you go, wow, the curtains next to her bed didn't burn. The books on the nightstand didn't burn. The wooden furniture didn't burn. Nothing burned except the mattress. So how do you get temperatures high enough to disintegrate bone. And then when you look at the photo of her, you realize that right next to that big black charred section, about 20% of her body is destroyed, and it's all carbonized. Right next to that is her hair, unburned hair. Well, we've all burned hair on our arms being around stoves just because it's the easiest thing on the body to burn. And technically, bones don't even burn, unless you get them up to thousands of degrees. I mean, normally in a cremation oven, which is about 1,600 degrees for about 2 hours, what's finished at the end of the cremation is bones and teeth, and they grind that up and say, here are your ashes. So there was something didn't work. Something did not make sense about the crime scene. And then I asked the obvious question, so what burned off her arm? I mean, the toaster? There's nothing in the apartment that could have possibly done that damage to her body. And once you realize that, you're left with the inescapable conclusion that whatever happened to Mary Sherman's body happened somewhere else, and they brought her back to her apartment to fake a murder scene. At that point, you know you have a cover-up, and you have to get to the questions, why are they covering this up? What is it that they're afraid of? Why did they go to all of this trouble to bring her back to her apartment? And in her apartment complex, there's about 13 apartments, and it's all oriented around a little courtyard, and everybody kind of knows everybody, and it's two stories. You know, so it's not one of these great things with hundreds of apartments. And neighbors who normally would hear Dr. Sherman walking around in her slippers at night didn't hear anything. So how do you do all this in silence, you know? And these were the initial questions that I got to when I started looking at the documents. And the other thing that intersects with this that was one of my initial questions, too, was this all happened in New Orleans in the 1960s. Well, Jim Garrison was the district attorney of New Orleans in the 1960s. And as Oliver Stone pointed out in his JFK movie, Jim Garrison starts investigating Oswald and the Kennedy assassination down in New Orleans. And because of that, he does an interview in Playboy magazine in 1967, the October issue. And in that, he gets a question about cancer about cancer killing Jack Ruby. And he says, well, I can't answer that because I don't have any evidence on it. But I can tell you that my investigators have determined that this Dr. Mary Sherman, who was murdered back in 64, was involved in some secret cancer research with David Ferry and some other doctors in New Orleans. Well, this is a mind-boggling comment because, as I pointed out, Mary Sherman is a world-class doctor with heavy credentials and contacts all over the country, and David Ferry has no medical credentials. He's a loose cannon. He's a defrocked priest. He had his commercial pilot's license pulled for basically a pederasty charge, and he's got one foot in the mob and one foot in the CIA, and he's flying missions into Cuba for the CIA. So what is this political loose cannon doing working with this world-class doctor on some kind of secret cancer experiments? And I didn't know, but I wanted to find out. And one of the things that Garrison had said was that his investigators had found a treatise on cancer that he had written in his apartment when they went to investigate it when he was murdered or died. Whether Ferry was murdered or not is another issue. But when he died, the investigators went in there because they had him under surveillance, and they found this cancer treatise. And yeah, I looked for it for years, and somebody finally heard I was looking for it. They found it up in the National Archives and sent it to me. And it's a very interesting document. The first thing I'll say about it is, though it was found in David Ferry's apartment, I will guarantee you that David Ferry did not write it, because it's written by somebody at a very high level in the cancer community, and they're talking about inviting professors from medical schools to come in and demonstrate certain things. And they're dealing with very sophisticated techniques and equipment, and it's very clear that the people who wrote this document know that viruses can cause cancer.
I'm speaking with author and researcher Edward Haslam. Today's show, Dr. Mary's Monkey, Part 1. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You mentioned at one point that the American Cancer Society's brochure on facts about cancer does not even mention viral theories of cancer. Why do you think this is?
Well, one of the ways you catch these people is they overplay their parts. They overcompensate. The idea that viruses could cause cancer was on the cover of Time magazine in 1959. Okay, it was a very public idea. And once they realized that they had a problem with the polio vaccine, which we'll be discussing in more detail here in a little bit, and the problem was that there was a cancer-causing virus in the polio vaccine, then they changed the drill and started saying that cancer could not be caused by a virus. Because if cancer cannot be caused by a virus, you don't have to worry about somebody saying there's a cancer-causing virus in the polio vaccine. But what happened on the story in this, I mean, most people familiar with the polio vaccine have no idea that the polio vaccine was grown on monkey kidney cells from the rhesus monkey. And in 1957, two researchers up at the National Cancer Institute, who were working with a bunch of hamsters at the time, found a virus that caused cancer. They named it polyoma, poly meaning many, oma meaning tumors. So this one virus caused multiple types of cancer in a variety of small mammals in the laboratory. And the moment they were able to prove that to the satisfaction of the management of the National Cancer Institute, Congress started throwing big money on them. And everyone was getting things like electron microscopes and stuff. And they started cataloging the viruses they were finding in the monkey labs. And by the time they found the 40th virus, which they named, simian is a word for monkey. It's a scientific term. So they named it simian virus number 40 or monkey virus number 40. And that they realized that that was the polyoma virus that Stuart and Eddie had discovered earlier. And they found that the natural host for this virus was the rhesus monkey. Well, that was a really big problem for everybody because they realized that they had grown the polio vaccine on rhesus monkey kidney cells. And when they took out the polio for the vaccine, they got all the other viruses that were in there. And they asked the excruciating question, and this is now in 1959, and they've been releasing the polio vaccine. They released it in 1955. Had they just mass inoculated the entire American population with a cancer-causing virus? And they found the virus in the polio vaccine, and they estimate that it was in 200 or 198 million doses of the polio vaccine, and they didn't realize until they had already released 100 million doses. So this, at this point, is the biggest mistake in history. I mean, nobody has ever made a mistake of this magnitude, and they didn't want to tell the public they had done it until they could figure out something to do about it. So it basically stamped it a secret, and it's at that point that places like the American Cancer Society stopped talking about viruses. They said 200 possible causes of cancer, and the word virus wasn't even in there, even though it had been on the cover of Time magazine not long before.
Now, the simian virus number 40, or SV40, that you mentioned, was a name given to this polyoma virus. Now, poly means many, right? And oma, tumors, right?
Yeah.
And like you said, the polio virus was grown in monkey kidneys. It was discovered that cancer-causing monkey viruses contaminated the polio vaccines, which you've been saying. What is the evidence that we are in the midst of a cancer epidemic?
Well, the moment I read Bernice Eddy's warning, essentially, about this, that it was in the polio vaccine, I said, she's trying to tell us, she's trying to warn us there's going to be an epidemic. And if she's right, it ought to be in the numbers. So I went to the medical library and I got the National Cancer Institute numbers on which were measured during Nixon's war on cancer from 1972 to 1988. The chart is in the back of my book from NCI. And I took those numbers and put them on my computer to make graphs. And once you do that, you notice that there is an obvious eruption of soft tissue cancers, that's breast, prostate, melanoma, and lymphoma, that starts, you know, the chart doesn't start to 72, and the contaminated vaccines were 55 through 63, though there are other issues like mother to child and sexual transmission and stuff. But what you see is you see in these numbers these four dramatic increases in the incidence rates of these soft tissue cancers, and it's all coming in right after the polio vaccine. So the question is, are these two events connected? Is the cancer-causing virus in the polio vaccine responsible for the epidemic of cancer? And the other thing is just, you know, I'm a great believer in common sense, okay? Just ask people, is there anybody in your friend or family circle that has cancer? I mean, I ask this question in public all the time, and nobody ever raises the hand to say, no, I don't know anybody. Everybody knows somebody that's got cancer. And that cancer used to be extremely rare. So we got back, and I've done the numbers on this, we got back about 20 cases of cancer for every one case of polio at the height of the polio epidemic. And the media was quite happy to run around and say, epidemic, epidemic, polio epidemic, you know, in the late 50s and mid-50s. And they don't really use that same kind of terminology when they're talking to cancer. I hardly ever hear, in fact, never in the mainstream, have cancer referred to as a cancer epidemic, but we are certainly in the middle of one. And you know, I think it's a reasonable argument to present that the cancer-causing viruses, the SV40 in particular, but also some other ones that were in the polio vaccines of the Salk and the Sabin vaccines, I'm going to talk about them in more detail in a little bit, are the trigger for why we have this cancer epidemic today.
Right. And when you talk about a cancer epidemic, you're talking specifically about four types of soft tissue cancer, right? Because other forms of cancer, the rate didn't rise that dramatically, did it?
No, in the chart that I have in the back of the book, and I just had to stick with that chart because they say some things that don't say other things. One of the things I noticed was if you say, there's about 20 types of cancer there. If you say, okay, well, here are the four that are going up, and I'm going to take lung out of this conversation just because of the cigarette issue. I don't want that to be a point of confusion. What happened to everything else? The other 16 types of cancer. Well, that line is flat. It didn't increase there. And what happens with soft tissues is the cells turn over faster. And in fact, the fastest cell in the body is the neuroglia in the brain. And child brain tumors went up so much before this 1972 cutoff point that where we start to see it in this, that it actually started to level out some. And then there are some other cancers, example, pleural mesothelioma. There were four or five cases of that cancer per year in the United States before the polio epidemic, and now there's about 2,500 cases per year. So that one went up dramatically, but they don't happen to show those numbers on that piece of paper that I was using as my reference.
Now, your book, Dr. Mary's Monkey, reads, it's actually a murder mystery. It's a page-turner, and you start from the very beginning in your childhood with all your questions about these mysterious goings-on in New Orleans, where you grew up. And as you mentioned before, you had actually sat on Dr. Mary Sherman's lap when you were a child. You devote a chapter to a biography of David Ferry, of all people, who, of course, is primarily known for his involvement in the assassination of President John Kennedy. How does David Ferry factor into your investigation of Dr. Mary Sherman's murder?
Well, the rumors I heard originally were that David Ferry was involved in an underground medical laboratory with Dr. Mary Sherman, and Garrison's investigators were suspicious that they were working on something to kill Fidel Castro. In my first version of the book, way back in 1995, I had that idea. I had heard those rumors, but I didn't have a witness. And then in the year 2000, I was contacted by CBS's 60 Minutes news team. And they said they were investigating a woman who kept telling them that she was the laboratory technician in the laboratory that I had written about involving David Ferry and Mary Sherman. And did I want to talk to them? And yes, I did. And they finally decided not to. They investigated this woman for 14 months and spent more money on that than anything they'd ever done in their 20-year history. But they decided not to air it for some reason. But because of their introduction, I got to know this woman and got to know her background and her story. And I am completely confident that she is.
You've been listening to Ed Haslam. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Ed Haslam is the author of one of the most bizarre and riveting books that I have ever read, Dr. Mary's Monkey: How the Unsolved Murder of a Doctor, a Secret Laboratory in New Orleans, and Cancer-Causing Monkey Viruses are Linked to Lee Harvey Oswald, the JFK Assassination, and Emerging Global Epidemics. Now, Ed and I have only scratched the very little, tiny beginning of this incredible story. This is a nonfiction book. It's all true. It has been released in an updated edition with 25 new pages, including documents from the FBI, the CIA, the Centers for Disease Control, and the New Orleans Police Department. The book is full of pictures, and it's been released in hardback. And I've got to tell you, this book is something else. I'm doing a two-part series and maybe even a three-part series with Ed Haslam on this book. This hardback book, 400 pages, is our incredible thank you gift today on Guns and Butter for your support of Free Speech Radio, KPFA, a generous donation of $100, and we would be delighted to send you this hardback Dr. Mary's Monkey. It was the updated edition was released on July 21st, 2014, on which marks the 50th anniversary of the murder of Dr. Mary Sherman. So I hope you will show your support today for Guns and Butter, for KPFA, and for the courageous Ed Haslam by giving us a call at 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732, $100, and we can send you this incredible book. And we're hoping you'll call and support us. 1-800-439-5732, Dr. Mary's Monkey. And at the end of part two, we find out who exactly was Mary's Monkey. It's actually not in the book. Ed brought that up. This book, it begins, Ed Haslam spent the first 35 years of his life in New Orleans. His father, as he said, was an orthopedic surgeon. He was a colleague of Dr. Mary Sherman. She was one of the leading cancer experts in America. She is bizarrely murdered, very, very bizarre. And all throughout Ed's life, he keeps bumping into this story in very uncanny and it's hard to say they were coincidences. It's almost as if he was meant to write this book. In fact, when he was an undergraduate at Tulane University in New Orleans, his girlfriend, Barbara, he went to visit her in her apartment in sort of a sleepy, lower middle class neighborhood in New Orleans. She had rented an apartment that had not had any occupants in it. For many years, she was the first tenant after it had been completely renovated. I think they'd replastered the walls, repainted it, resurfaced the floors, but there was this funny smell in there, and she was always baking bread to cover up this smell. And there was some strange woman that lived down in the basement. This is all in Ed's book, who used to say to her, talk to her about those terrible men that did these horrible things to those poor animals. Well, it wasn't decades later, when Ed was researching this book, that he found out that that apartment that he was in, probably around maybe 1969, something like that, that was actually the very apartment that David Ferry of JFK assassination fame, that was his underground laboratory that he had in conjunction with Dr. Mary Sherman, and he had had cages of thousands of mice in that apartment. Dr. Mary's Monkey, this is, I couldn't put it down, 400 pages, and it reads like a novel, but it's all true, documented. You can't make this stuff up. 1-800-439-5732. A generous $100 donation to KPFA today, and we would be delighted to furnish you with this incredible book. I cannot speak highly enough of it. It is, well, you can't make it up. It's more bizarre than a novel. 1-800-439-5732. And very, very important. What do you think? Should we play a little bit more of my interview with Ed Haslam? He's now getting into the technician.
That's a really important part of the story. She watched her grandmother die as a middle schooler, okay, and she was just determined from the first days of adolescence that she wanted to be the person to cure cancer, because she hated the disease. And during high school, she starts doing all these experiments, and she's got access to radiation. She's got access to cancer. She's giving cancer to mice in 7 days. Okay, by the time she's a senior in high school. Well, when the, and she's getting help from, like, the Army and places like that. I mean, she's got connections through this WizKid program that she's getting a lot of help from people, sophisticated people. And in the spring of 1961, she actually goes up and crashes the press briefing of the American Cancer Society, which is being held just up the road from where she lives, but it's being held in St. Petersburg. And she's got her high school press pass and all of her research notes, and they're getting ready to kick her out. And somebody up at the head table said, oh, wait a minute, before you kick this girl out, let's find out who she is and why she's doing this, because we've never had this happened before. And she said, I got all this research. I'm giving cancer to mice in 7 days. And they said, well, that's interesting, because, like, nobody is doing it that fast. Are you serious about this? And she said, yeah, I got everything back in my lab. And so they make some phone calls, and a team of people go back with her to her laboratory in Bradenton, Florida, at Manatee High School, and they realize that she is very serious. What she's doing is very dangerous, so they close out her lab. But they are convinced that she is actually doing what she said she was doing. And therefore, they bring her up to Buffalo, New York, to the Roswell Park Cancer Institute, and they have her spend the summer working in Dr. Moore's lab. Dr. Moore's the director of the thing, and they teach her how to handle cancer-causing viruses, and they teach her how to do certain blood things, and they train her on radiation more efficiently than she had been trained before. And we have newspaper articles on all the covering all this stuff. I mean, she's got the document trail on this. And after they've trained her, they've got experiments they want her to do, because these guys all know about the contamination of the polio vaccine. The leadership knows, all right? It's the public that doesn't know. And they've got questions that they don't want to ask in public. For example, if you take somebody who's had this contaminated vaccine, they got SV40 in their blood, and you give them a chest x-ray, will the x-ray trigger the SV40 to start the cancer? I mean, that's an enormous question, because that threatens the entire use of radiation in American medicine. And they've got Judy working on this at the University of Florida. Senator Smathers put her in there, and she doesn't have to pay tuition, she doesn't have to pay room and board, but she's doing all this research for them. She's got access to the radiation equipment, and she is sending reports back to Dr. Ochsner on a monthly basis. And this is happening in the fall of 1962.
I'm speaking with author and researcher Edward Haslam. Today's show, Dr. Mary's Monkey, Part 1. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Well, the other thing that happens in the fall of 1962 is the Cuban Missile Crisis. And if you live in the South, you know, it's kind of a big magnifying glass because you're the ones close to Cuba, all right? And I remember sitting there as a kid watching the big circle on the television set of the range of the missiles, and New Orleans is inside the range of the missiles. I'm sitting in New Orleans wondering if we're going to get nuked before the late show, you know? And the whole thing with this is the Cold War, and people kind of forget about the sins of the paranoid age of the Cold War. But the when Castro took over Cuba, there was an embargo after he nationalized, you know, the Rockefeller's factories and the Bush's oil platforms and stuff. And that embargo cost New Orleans 25% of its trade. Well, trade's the business of New Orleans, like cars are the business of Detroit. So New Orleans was really, like, on edge about Castro, and in the first place, and then Castro is threatening to take his revolution to Central and South America, and if he does that, there go the bananas, and there go the coffee beans, and the economic effect on New Orleans would be huge, and then you add these Russian nuclear missiles on top of it, and the people in New Orleans are starting to say, this Castro guy's got to go. Well, one of the things we know today about that through the Church Committee and stuff is we know, and the CIA has admitted that they were working with the mafia on means of killing Fidel Castro. Well, one of the means they were doing was weaponizing this cancer. And one of the things, I'm kind of jumping around here, and forgive me for this, but this timeline of when they find out about the contamination of polio vaccine, and they know this by the late 50s, by 1959. And the question is, what did they do once they knew, all right? And they got really dizzy trying to make a anti-cancer vaccine. Well, today we have the HPV vaccine, so there's no hiding the fact that there's cancer-causing viruses, and they finally developed vaccines. But back then, it was a really off the wall idea, and but they knew the dimensions of the problem was like bigger than war. I mean, you know, this was horrible. So they set up this medical Manhattan project where they were going to use radiation to mutate the monkey viruses. And they needed this done on federal property because nobody wanted it done on their property. And they set this up on the grounds of the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital in New Orleans. Now, this hospital has a big campus, got about 13 buildings on it, a great big central hospital in the middle. But in the back, they had some smaller buildings, and they set up this linear particle accelerator in what became known as the Infectious Disease Laboratory Building. And they assembled like an A-team to work on it. This was done under the direction of Alton Ochsner, who had been president of the American Cancer Society. I've got his FBI file. He's got a 40-year history of secret assignments with the American government, particularly the military. He's done stuff with the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Public Health Service, FBI, and one other unnamed agency. And we've got other people in town that we can identify who have biowarfare backgrounds, like Jose Rivera. He goes from working in Fort Detrick to being the head of the National Institute of Neurology and Blindness. And in between those two assignments, we find him in New Orleans, right down the street from the Linear Particle Accelerator, teaching introductory biology at Loyola University. So he's a half mile from Ochsner's house and a half mile from this public health facility. And there are others. And Sarah Stewart is the person who has discovered the cancer-causing virus in the first place. She is the world expert on it. And in 1960, right when they're starting this, she transfers from the National Institute to the National Public Health Service. I mean, an odd career move, except for the fact that it puts her in control of the facility in New Orleans where they're mutating the monkey viruses trying to develop an anti-cancer vaccine. And, you know, they all think they're going to win, you know, and come out with an anti-cancer vaccine that could be used to stop the cancer epidemic from the polio vaccine. But when this thing happens in 62 with the Russian missiles, it changes the whole complexion of the thing. And what happens is they start working on, they say, we're going to use the radiation to make this stuff more powerful rather than benign. And instead of making a vaccine, we're going to make a biological weapon that we can inject into somebody like Fidel Castro, and he will die and he'll never be blamed on us, because as we all know, you can't give anybody cancer. So that's what's going on there. And in the spring of 1963, Judy gets a phone call.
Now, you're talking about Judith Vary Baker, right, who wrote Lee and Me.
Right. Judith Vary Baker, is the, her memoir, autobiography, is called Me and Lee, How I Came to Know, Love, and Lose Lee Harvey Oswald. But she hasn't met Lee Oswald yet, okay? She's just down at the University of Florida doing these cancer experiments for Dr. Ochsner. And Ochsner calls her and says, Judy, how would you like to skip the last 2 years of college and start medical school in September, and we'll pay your tuition and your room and board and give you a stipend, and you'll be working this summer under the direction of that famous cancer doctor, Dr. Mary Sherman, and this will be a really important assignment for the country, and so would you like to do this, Judy? And it's a hard question to say no to. So she says yes, and she heads into New Orleans. Ochsner sends her a bus ticket. And when she gets there a little early, and they kind of have a loose cannon on the deck. And so they send somebody in to be her babysitter. And this person is, they've got a cover job set up for her. They've got an apartment they need to get her in. But again, she's a little bit early, so things aren't working quite right. But this person they send in is from New Orleans. He's got one foot in the mafia because of his family connections here. He's got the other foot in the CIA because he's been working with them for years. And his name is Lee Harvey Oswald. And he is a operational support person helping out with this secret laboratory. And what's going on is they have a string of laboratories set up across the city. One of them is in David Ferry's apartment. And across the street from David Ferry's apartment, we have what we call the Mouse House, which is where my girlfriend Barbara lived. And they have thousands of mice in cages in that house. And they have two Cuban guys in there who are taking care of the mice. And when the mice develop these big tumors, they put them into a cardboard box, and they bring them over to David Ferry's house. And then Judy and Lee go over to David Ferry's house, sometimes with David and sometimes without him. And they kill the mice. They cut out the tumors. They grind up the tumors in a blender. They put all this stuff into test tubes. They make slides and stuff. And then they pack all that up into like a lunchbox kind of thing. And then Judy cleans up the place to laboratory standards, puts everything away. Now it looks like a normal kitchen again, so nobody will even imagine it was a laboratory. And then she takes all this stuff over to Mary Sherman's apartment. She has a key to Mary Sherman's apartment. So she just goes and lets herself in, puts the stuff in the refrigerator or whatever, and sits down and reads for a while, and then goes back to work. Now, Lee Oswald and Judith Vary Baker are both working at the Riley Coffee Company. This was a cover job set up for them And
too much. Can you believe it? And we're only getting started with this most bizarre story that I've ever heard in New Orleans. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. We are in our fun drive here at Free Speech Radio KPFA. And I am delighted to be able to offer you a updated edition in hardback, 400 pages, full of photos and documents, Dr. Mary's Monkey, published on the 21st of July of this year to mark the anniversary of the murder, actually, of a very famous, internationally known cancer expert, Dr. Mary Sherman. Dr. Mary's Monkey, our gift today to you for a $100 donation to KPFA by giving us a call at 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. The 1964 murder of a nationally known cancer researcher sets the stage for this gripping exposé of medical professionals enmeshed in covert government operations over the course of 3 decades. Following a trail of police records, FBI files, cancer statistics, and medical journals, this revealing book presents evidence of a web of medical secret-keeping that began with the handling of evidence in the JFK assassination and continued apace, sweeping doctors into cover-ups of cancer outbreaks, contaminated polio vaccine, the arrival of the AIDS virus, and biological weapon research using infected monkeys. Dr. Mary's Monkey, a gift to you today in hardback, 400 pages, updated with 25 new pages, Dr. Mary's Monkey, for a $100 donation by giving us a call at 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Please support the courageous work of Ed Haslam. He has lived with this story his entire life. The book reads like a suspenseful murder mystery, which in fact it is, but it's nonfiction. And I'll tell you, I couldn't put it down. 1-800-439-5732. $100, and we would be delighted to provide you with Dr. Mary's Monkey. And who else but Chris Milligan at Trine Day would have the courage to publish this incredible, incredible book? 1-800-439-5732. You know, when Dr. Mary Sherman was murdered in the most bizarre fashion imaginable, it was the first time that Ed Haslam said his father was called to identify her body, to make a second opinion. And Ed said in his book that his father came home, fixed himself a drink, sat down, and it was the first and only time he ever saw his father cry. His father was an orthopedic surgeon, and he was a colleague of world-famous Dr. Mary Sherman. His father would not speak about the incident to Ed, though. And Ed's last chance to talk to his father and try and get some information about this murder was on his father's deathbed. His father still refused to talk to him about it. He says when he asked his father what was going on there with that, he shook his head slowly from side to side to let me know that he would not tell me. I persisted and I wanted to know why he would not tell me. Solemnly, he said, "There might be repercussions. I have to think about the family first. I have to protect them." And then Ed says to his father, "What if I figure it out for myself?" "I'm hardly in a position to stop you," he said, with casual resignation of a man who never expected to see another football game. Then he collected his thoughts, and in a grave voice, he gave me this warning, quote, "Ed, I need you to listen to me carefully. I will not be able to say this to you again. If you do figure out what happened down there and decide to tell the world what you found, I need you to realize that you will be crossing swords with the most powerful people in our country, and you should think twice before crossing them, unquote. Dr. Mary's Monkey, a $100 donation to Free Speech Radio, KPFA, and we would be delighted to provide you with this incredible book. Believe me, take it from me, you won't regret it. 1-800-439-5732. Ed's father was particularly concerned about goings-on at the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital in New Orleans. And this has to do with the three-story secret linear particle accelerator. And it was a real detective job for Ed to try and find this place decades later and figure out where this machine had been and what had happened to Mary Sherman. 1-800-439-5732, Dr. Mary's Monkey, How the Unsolved Murder of a Doctor, a Secret Laboratory in New Orleans, and Cancer-Causing Monkey Viruses are Linked to Lee Harvey Oswald, the JFK Assassination, and Emerging Global Epidemics. It's so strange. There's so many things happening in New Orleans in the 60s, and they all, it has to do with the JFK assassination. He mentions, he talks about a Playboy interview that Jim Garrison gave, a lengthy one, where he talks about this laboratory and Mary Sherman. So it all links into the assassination. And then, of course, Lee Harvey Oswald actually intimately involved with this underground laboratory in an apartment, of all people, of David Ferry. David Ferry, who's working with Dr. Mary Sherman. We also hear about Jack Ruby in the book. Jack Ruby was involved. He was in the, he'd been to the laboratory, and he apparently, it turns out, knew Lee Harvey Oswald since they were boys. Like I said before, you can't make this up. Dr. Mary's Monkey, 400 pages, full of many, many photos. This is the only book I've ever read which has such extensive photos. So it makes for a very interesting read. It's all indexed. There are documents from the FBI, the CIA, the Centers for Disease Control, and the New Orleans Police Department. Dr. Mary's Monkey, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. $100 will get you this incredible book in hardback. Florida is one of the states where some of this stuff originated. That's where Judith Vary Baker came from before she was recruited by Dr. Ochsner. Now, actually, Dr. Ochsner was Mary Sherman's boss, and he ran the world-famous Ochsner Clinic in New Orleans. And in part two of Dr. Mary's Monkey, we go into depth about him. Quite a controversial figure, very controversial. In fact, when there were doubts expressed about this polio vaccine, which Ed Haslam was talking about, there were some, actually a lot of female cancer researchers were involved in uncovering the contamination of the polio virus. Dr. Ochsner was against them stopping the polio vaccination, which I guess started in the mid-50s and went to 1962, I think. He publicly, I mean, this is hard to believe, but true, he publicly inoculated his grandson and his granddaughter with the polio virus, and his grandson died, and his granddaughter was paralyzed, but I believe that she did recover. Unbelievable. I mean, that's just one of the facts in this incredible book, Dr. Mary's Monkey, by Edward Haslam. Our gift to you today for a $100 pledge to KPFA by giving us a call at 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. $100, and you will receive this incredible book. It's a hardback. It's not a paperback. They wanted to reissue a book that would be good in libraries. And this is a real thriller, but it's all true. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 439-5732, $100 for Dr. Mary's Monkey. Did inoculating millions of trusting school children with polio vaccines contaminated by monkey viruses trigger an epidemic of soft tissue cancers? Was a desperate effort to develop an anti-cancer vaccine diverted secretly into biological weapons? Is there a link between these covert experiments and AIDS? And do the answers to these vexing questions connect to the intrigue swirling around the assassination of President Kennedy? Dr. Mary's Monkey, 1-800-439-5732, $100 will get you the book. Of course, we value all of your pledges. $25 will make you a voting member of KPFA for 1 year. 1-800-439-5732. Dr. Mary's Monkey just reissued, updated edition on July 21st, 2014. More than a spirited page-turner, this riveting fresh look at a cold case murder mystery is bound to make its own headlines. Here is a book of profound importance that helps us fathom what has really happened in our country. The grisly homicide of a nationally known surgeon in 1964 New Orleans sets the stage for a chilling expose of scientists, spooks in shadowy hidden laboratories. When New Orleans native Ed Haslam began his modest investigation into the curious life and shocking death of the brilliant Tulane medical professor, Dr. Mary Sherman, he couldn't have imagined that this inquiry would connect some of the city's most prominent citizens to lone nut Lee Harvey Oswald, to the mafia, and to forces high inside the U.S. government. Nor that these new discoveries would ultimately change our understanding of a fateful November day in Dallas. But they have. Dr. Mary's Monkey, 400 pages in hardback by Edward T. Haslam, 1-800-439-5732, a $100 pledge to support the work of courageous Ed Haslam, to support Free Speech Radio KPFA, and to vote for the kind of programming that Yara Mako and I, Bonnie Faulkner, bring you every week on Guns and Butter. Now, obviously, I was not able to play you the entire hour-long interview today, and I also have a part two already produced, and probably one of these days in the not-too-distant future, I will replay both shows in their entirety so you'll be able to hear them both. Dr. Mary's Monkey, 1-800-439-5732, $100, and we'll send you this incredible new book, Dr. Mary's Monkey, How the Unsolved Murder of a Doctor, a Secret Laboratory in New Orleans, and Cancer-Causing Monkey Viruses are Linked to Lee Harvey Oswald, the JFK Assassination, and Emerging Global Epidemics. I've got about 1.5 minutes left. I'd love to get a few more of you on the phone. Of course, you can always pledge securely online at www.kpfa.org. Click on the donation button, look at the $100 gifts, and you'll find Dr. Mary's Monkey. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, Dr. Mary's Monkey, a $100 generous donation to KPFA today, and we would be delighted to send you this book. If you'd like to contact me, please contact me at Faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. That's FAULKNER@GUNSANDBUTTER.org. Thank you so very much, all of you who have called. We are very grateful for those calls and for your very generous support of KPFA. Keep those calls coming. 1-800-439-5732, Dr. Mary's Monkey, 400 pages in hardback for a $100 donation. 1-800-439-5732. Thank you so much. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. We'll talk to you next week.
Something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is, ain't exactly clear.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap. You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, the second half of Harold Pinter's stunning 2005 speech. It's on truth, lies, and war. And the United States government does get mentioned here and there. I hope you'll stay tuned. This week, we continue with more of the fine Nobel Prize acceptance speech of the fine English playwright, Harold Pinter. It's the 10th anniversary of the speech, more or less, given in December 2005, and it's the 85th anniversary of Pinter's birth on October 10, 1930, in Hackney, London County, UK. He died in 2008. Pinter titled his Nobel acceptance speech, Art, Truth, and Politics. Last week, in the first part, Pinter contrasted the world of dramatic art with the world of public affairs. In art, truth is slippery, uncertain, unknowable. Maybe it doesn't even exist. But in the real world, for practical purposes, truth does exist. Truth is knowable. But governments don't admit the truth of what their own foreign policies actually are. Governments don't admit the truth of the murder and plunder they commit abroad in order to enrich business interests at home. The citizens don't know the truth because the government has woven what Pinter memorably calls a vast tapestry of lies. If citizens knew the truth of the bloodshed and devastation the government is creating abroad, they would be appalled. They would compel change. Governments act like bandits routinely. But last week, Pinter called out the worst offender, as he sees it, the government of the United States. He focused on two examples, the U.S. invasion of Iraq from 2003, and the bloody campaign to overthrow the reformist democratic government of Nicaragua in the 1980s. This week, he takes on official hypocrisy, the illegal imprisonments at Guantanamo, nuclear weapons insanity, and what dropping bombs on civilians is actually like, seen from the ground. Let's return to Harold Pinter.
The United States no longer bothers about low-intensity conflict. It no longer sees any point in being reticent or even devious. It puts its cards on the table without fear or favor. It quite simply doesn't give a damn about the United Nations, international law, or critical dissent, which it regards as impotent and irrelevant. It also has its own bleating little lamb tagging behind it on a lead. The pathetic and supine Great Britain. What has happened to our moral sensibility? Did we ever have any? What do these words mean? Do they refer to a term very rarely employed these days? Conscience? A conscience to do not only with our own acts, but to do with our shared responsibility in the acts of others. Is all this dead? Look at Guantanamo Bay. Hundreds of people detained without charge for over 3 years, with no legal representation or due process, technically detained forever. This totally illegitimate structure is maintained in defiance of the Geneva Convention. It is not only tolerated, but hardly thought about by what's called the international community. This criminal outrage is being committed by a country which declares itself to be the leader of the free world. Do we think about the inhabitants of Guantanamo Bay? What does the media say about them? They pop up occasionally, a small item on page 6. They have been consigned to a no-man's land, from which, indeed, they may never return. At present, many are on hunger strike, being force-fed, including British residents. No niceties in these force-feeding procedures. No sedative or anaesthetic. Just a tube stuck up your nose and into your throat. You vomit blood. This is torture. What has the British Foreign Secretary said about this? Nothing. What has the British Prime Minister said about this? Nothing. Why not? Because the United States has said to criticize our conduct in Guantanamo Bay constitutes an unfriendly act. You're either with us or against us. So Blair shuts up. The invasion of Iraq was a bandit act, an act of blatant state terrorism, demonstrating absolute contempt for the concept of international law. The invasion was an arbitrary military action, inspired by a series of lies upon lies and gross manipulation of the media and therefore of the public. An act intended to consolidate American military and economic control of the Middle East, masquerading as a last resort, all other justifications having failed to justify themselves as liberation. A formidable assertion of military force responsible for the death and mutilation of thousands and thousands of innocent people. We have brought torture, cluster bombs, depleted uranium, innumerable acts of random murder, misery, degradation and death to the Iraqi people, and call it bringing freedom and democracy to the Middle East. How many people do you have to kill before you qualify to be described as a mass murderer and a war criminal? 100,000. More than enough, I would have thought. Therefore, it is just that Bush and Blair be arraigned before the International Criminal Court of Justice. But Bush has been clever. He has not ratified the International Criminal Court of Justice. Therefore, if any American soldier, or for that matter politician, finds himself in the dock, Bush is warned that he will send in the Marines. But Tony Blair has ratified the court and is therefore available for prosecution. We can let the court have his address if they're interested. It is number 10, Downing Street, London. Death, in this context, is irrelevant. Both Bush and Blair place death well away on the back burner. At least 100,000 Iraqis were killed by American bombs and missiles before the Iraq insurgency began. These people are of no moment. Their deaths don't exist. They are blank. They're not even recorded as being dead. We don't do body counts, said the American general, Tommy Franks. Early in the invasion, there was a photograph published on the front page of British newspapers of Tony Blair kissing the cheek of a little Iraqi boy. A grateful child, said the caption. A few days later, there was a story and photograph on an inside page of another four-year-old boy with no arms. His family had been blown up by a missile. He was the only survivor. "When do I get my arms back?" he asked. This story was never referred to again. Well, Tony Blair wasn't holding him in his arms, nor the body of any other mutilated child, nor the body of any bloody corpse. Blood is dirty. Dirty is your shirt and tie when you're making a sincere speech on television. The 2,000 American dead are an embarrassment. They are transported to their graves in the dark. Funerals are unobtrusive, out of harm's way. The mutilated rot in their beds, some for the rest of their lives. So the dead and the mutilated both rot in different kinds of graves. Here is an extract from a poem by Pablo Neruda, and explaining a few things. "And one morning, all that was burning. One morning, the bonfires leapt out of the earth, devouring human beings. And from then on, fire, gunpowder from then on. And from then on, blood. Bandits with planes and moors. Bandits with finger rings and duchesses. Bandits with black friars spattering blessings came through the sky to kill children. And the blood of children ran through the streets without fuss, like children's blood. Jackals that the jackals would despise. Stones that the dry thistle would bite on and spit out. Vipers that the vipers would abominate. Face to face with you, I have seen the blood of Spain tower like a tide to drown you in one wave of pride and knives. Traitorous generals, see my dead house. Look at broken Spain. From every house, burning metal flows instead of flowers. From every socket of Spain, Spain emerges, and from every dead child, a rifle with eyes. And from every crime, bullets are born, which will one day find the bullseye of your hearts. And you will ask, why doesn't his poetry speak of dreams and leaves and the great volcanoes of his native land? Come and see the blood in the streets. Come and see the blood in the streets. Come and see the blood in the streets. Let me make it quite clear that in quoting from Neruda's poem, I am in no way comparing Republican Spain to Saddam Hussein's Iraq. I quote Neruda because nowhere in contemporary poetry have I read such a powerful, visceral description of the bombing of civilians. I have said earlier that the United States is now totally frank about putting its cards on the table. That is the case. Its official declared policy is now defined as full-spectrum dominance. That is not my term. It is theirs. Full-spectrum dominance means control of land, sea, air and space, and all attendant resources. The United States now occupies 702 military installations throughout the world in 132 countries, with the honorable exception of Sweden, of course. We don't quite know how they got there, but they are there, all right. The United States possesses 8,000 active and operational nuclear warheads. 2,000 are on hair trigger alert, ready to be launched with 15 minutes warning. is developing new systems of nuclear force known as bunker busters. The British, ever cooperative, are intending to replace their own nuclear missile, Trident. Who, I wonder, are they aiming at? Osama bin Laden. You? Me? Joe Dokes? China? Paris? Who knows? What we do know is that this infantile insanity, the possession and threatened use of nuclear weapons, is at the heart of present American political philosophy. We must remind ourselves that the United States is on a permanent military footing and shows no sign of relaxing it. Many thousands, if not millions of people in the United States itself are demonstrably sickened, shamed, and angered by their government's actions. But as things stand, they are not a coherent political force yet. But the anxiety, uncertainty, and fear which we can see growing daily in the United States is unlikely to diminish. I know that President Bush has many extremely competent speechwriters, but I would like to volunteer for the job myself. I propose the following short address, which he can make on television to the nation. I see him grave, hair carefully combed, serious, winning, sincere, often beguiling, sometimes employing a wry smile, curiously attractive, a man's man. God is good. God is great. God is good. My God is good. Bin Laden's God is bad. His is a bad God. Saddam's God was bad, except he didn't have one. He was a barbarian. We are not barbarians. We don't chop people's heads off. We believe in freedom. So does God. I am not a barbarian. I am the democratically elected leader of a freedom-loving democracy. We are a compassionate society. We give compassionate electrocution and compassionate lethal injection. We are a great nation. I am not a dictator. He is. I am not a barbarian. He is. They all are. I possess moral authority. You see this fist? This is my moral authority, and don't you forget it. A writer's life is a highly vulnerable, almost naked activity. We don't have to weep about that. The writer makes his choice and is stuck with it. But it is true to say that you are open to all the winds. Some of them I see indeed. You are out on your own, out on a limb. You find no shelter, no protection. Unless you lie, in which case, of course, you have constructed your own protection and, it could be argued, become a politician. I have referred to death quite a few times in this speech. I shall now quote a poem of my own called Death. Where was the dead body found? Who found the dead body? Was the dead body dead when found? How was the dead body found? Who was the dead body? Who was the father or daughter or brother or uncle or sister or mother or son of the dead and abandoned body? Was the body dead when abandoned? Was the body abandoned? By whom had it been abandoned? Was the dead body naked or dressed for a journey? What made you declare the dead body dead? Did you declare the dead body dead? How well did you know the dead body? How did you know the dead body was dead? Did you wash the dead body? Did you close both its eyes? Did you bury the body? Did you leave it abandoned? Did you kiss the dead body? When we look into a mirror, we think the image that confronts us is accurate. But move a millimeter, and the image changes. We are actually looking at a never-ending range of reflections. But sometimes, a writer has to smash the mirror. For it is on the other side of that mirror that the truth stares at us. I believe that despite the enormous odds which exist, unflinching, unswerving, fierce intellectual determination as citizens to define the real truth of our lives and our societies is a crucial obligation which devolves upon us all. It is, in fact, mandatory. If such a determination is not embodied in our political vision, we have no hope of restoring what is so nearly lost to us, the dignity of man.
That was the late British playwright Harold Pinter with his stunning Nobel Prize acceptance speech of 2005. He was one of the most important playwrights writing in English in the second half of the 20th century. His honors included the Nobel Prize for Literature and, from France, the Legion of Honor. He died in 2008. I made a mistake last week talking about Prime Minister Tony Blair's British honors and Pinter's lack of British honors. He never became Sir Harold Pinter, I said, and that was correct. But in fact, Pinter had been offered a knighthood in 2009, and he declined. After resigning as Prime Minister in 2007, Tony Blair was offered not a mere knighthood, but a higher honor, a life peerage, a barony. But it turns out that Blair, too, declined the honor. So, while there was never Sir Harold Pinter, at least there is no Sir Tony Blair either. Thank God for small favors, and I apologize for getting the story not quite right last week. Anyway, we do have Sir Paul McCartney, Sir George Harrison, and Sir Richard Starkey, known to the commoners as Ringo. But I digress.
Union Carbide, they go by so many names, but for the land and the people destroyed by their greed, the story is always the same. McDonald's requires McDonnell Douglas, United Fruit needed U.S. Marines, the freedom of their market, supported by fascist regimes, the invisible hand, the market is only one of two, wielded by the corporate elite and dressed in red, white, and blue. In one fist an M16 rifle, in the other one $1,000 bill. If the right fist doesn't get you, then the other one surely will. The rhetoric
you're so thick as they tell us we're free, and we've got to cut right through their lies. It's not freedom to choose our own destinies, it's freedom to choose our demise. You can die for their money, you can die by their guns, they'll let you choose your own fate. If you get in the way of their profits, you can be sure you'll be burned at the stake. The invisible hand of the market is only one of two, wielded by the corporate elite and dressed in red, white, and blue. In one fist an M16 rifle, in the other one $1,000 bill. If the right fist doesn't get you, then the other one surely will.
They opened fire on the people, and these were true.
People say, "Wow, this is so cute."
This is CBC Radio.
We don't need no great hand coming down from the sky, or your soldiers in olive drab marching on by. To discipline, regulate, liberalize, legislate, we decline. Without you, we were just doing fine. The invisible hand of the market is only one of two, wielded by the corporate elite and dressed in red, white, and blue. In one fist an M16 rifle, in the other one $1,000 bill. If the right fist doesn't get you, then the other.
That was Ethan Miller and Kate Boberman from their Invisible Hand. They remind us of a point that Harold Pinter mentions, but does not elaborate on. Governments commit military aggression and atrocities abroad, not for their national glory, and certainly not to protect their own citizens. As Michael Parenti nicely put it, the goal of U.S. foreign policy is to make the world safe for the Fortune 500. Or, as Kate Boberman sang, McDonald's needs McDonnell Douglas. United Fruit needs the U.S. Marines. The latter refers to the U.S.-led overthrow of the democratic government of Guatemala in the 1950s and its replacement with a military dictatorship, done to protect the profits of the United Fruit Company, now Chiquita Brands. But time is late, so don't get me started. Chaz K. kindly sent me the song you just heard, and you kindly listened to our show, and the University of Hartford kindly holds the license to and helps support the show's home station, WWUH-FM, in the West Hartford section of Darkest Connecticut. Harold Pinter wrote and delivered a stunning, powerful speech, and the Nobel Prize Committee has kept it available. I thank you, one and all. Illegitimite non-carborundum, remember that war is not healthy for children and other living things, and please come back again next week. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear the first part of an interview between author Rebecca Roth, who wrote the book Methodical Illusion, and Red Ice radio show host Henrik Palmgren from Sweden. The website is rediceradio.net. Rebecca Roth is a retired flight attendant, international purser, a volunteer firefighter, and has been trained as an emergency medical technician. The interview started with the question, why did she write the book? So let's begin with her response.
Well, this is an interesting story in and of itself. You know, when I had nearly a 30-year career, and while I was flying, I always had exciting things happen to me. And if there was a sports star or a movie star or somebody, and next thing you know, I'm out to dinner with them. So all my coworkers always encouraged me to write a book while I was flying. Well, I retired in 2004 or thereabouts. And around 2008 or 9, somewhere in there, you know, when you're retired, you don't pay that much attention. And it just kind of caught me off guard what happened. I started to write a book, and it was going to be really just a novel about flight attendants and that lifestyle and different, you know, things that happened. So all the people that I knew and met and experiences I had over those long, exciting years that I put in. And I wanted to introduce a character that was of a Middle Eastern name, a gentleman, for a date for a character that I had. And so I just Google searched, and lo and behold, what happened to me? I Google searched the 19 Arab hijackers from 9/11. And what popped up in front of me was a BBC article claiming that several of the hijackers were still alive. And this was dated September 23rd, 2001. Now, just so you know, after 9/11, I was home watching it on television unfold. During that time I was flying, I absolutely could not look into what the heck had happened and why we didn't have jets scrambled within 6 minutes. So I was in what we call cognitive dissonance. I was afraid to look any deeper. And when I found those guys were still alive and that the Saudi government was actually suing the United States Federal Bureau of Investigation over the use of not just these people's names, but their photos and their home addresses in Saudi Arabia. Well, you know, then now it's a drone strike. They do that to you. But yeah. I mean, I was like, what? I read through that article twice and it was a hammer over my head. I had never really looked in depth, but I knew something was wrong from day one. And when I was in the airline, the thing I found strange about the whole entire 9/11 event was that no one ever spoke to us about it. No one talked about how they got in the cockpit, what happened, all the details of those four planes. And that was something we always did, is review incidents like that in our yearly training. And so I got into a full-blown research. I went into this for a couple years, probably 20 hours a day. I was pretty crazed. Luckily, my husband came along on the trip with me.
Well, that's good. Yeah, could be shattering relationships otherwise, right?
It is unbelievable how many people have contacted me after the book has come out and told me of their stories of how they got onto that, going down the rabbit hole, as we say, and their spouse refused to go and refused to hear it, and that it broke up so many relationships. But fortunately, my husband and I both did the research together, and what I found literally shocked me into, I was physically sick when I made the discovery of what I did, and all of the information surrounding the whole 9/11 event, I often refer to myself as that guy in Close Encounters of the Third Kind that built the devil's tower in his house. I mean, I had charts all over my office. I had the National Transportation Safety Board data where they claimed the airplanes were descending 6 to 10,000 feet a minute. And yet we had a flight attendant sitting on the phone with no background sounds. It was everything calm, and her voice was calm, just saying goodbye to her husband and kids. And just all these anomalies popped up. And I mean, I charted them, so they didn't just totally pop up. But I thought, well, gee, that's an interesting thing for her to do. And the fact that the flight attendants and the pilots didn't follow our training, and we're very well trained. That's all we do. That's what we're there for. I know you think it's the pillow blanket and the Coke and 7-Up and the cocktails, right. But actually we're just trained to help you in the event of any emergency, including a hijacking. So we are the persons that are in control. And if you've ever been involved in any kind of an incident, whether it's decompression or a heart attack or something on board an aircraft, you will see flight attendants immediately go into that trained mode where you are trained to do that. And you don't even stop and think about it, whether you lose your landing gear on landing, the commands that are drilled into us, and the step-by-step protocols for hijacking. And those were the things that I started to see were not followed by the crew. Then I started looking into the details that the passengers said, along with what the FAA and the National Transportation Safety Board were claiming the planes were doing. And I thought, nah, that can't be right. And so I really just dug into this. After I gathered all the information, I thought, if I put this out there, I will be a drone strike. I mean, this is 2015, right? I actually wrote this book 2 years ago. And so when people read it, they're really amazed, because the opening scene starts out with the president of the United States being impeached over the Benghazi arms deals to actually a spinoff of Al-Qaeda from Syria. And so we are looking now. I didn't know ISIS even existed then. And as I dug into who runs Al-Qaeda, I know they're not really a serious terrorist group, because they're involved with the Israeli and the United States intelligence agencies. Yeah, so, yeah. You know, I think it was kind of a interesting thing how I wrote this book, and then all of a sudden life starts imitating it. But I didn't know what to do with the information. I thought people really wouldn't be able to handle it. And so I thought, well, I'll write it in a novel, and that gives me some a little sense of plausible deniability, so to speak. And so, you know, I invite the reader, contact me through the website. A lot of the 9/11 stuff is real, and it's truthful, and it is from FBI documents. And so when I discovered things like the women involved, these are on in FBI documents, two women. At least one, but I think two, are involved, and kind of traced back a little history onto who they were through my characters. All of that background for those women was the FBI. And the things that I found that were really interesting and really most shocking to me as an American is the FBI was covering that up, as well as the media. I studied this stuff for thousands of hours, and I was in final edit of the first edition. The second edition is going to be coming out here in the next week or so. There's also a foreword by a United Airlines retired 767 pilot, and some really great endorsements from people that are involved in the 9/11 truth movement. So that's basically the only change. Yeah, it's kind of exciting things that I found. And as I woke up from my cognitive dissonance and started researching, I realized that I was a typical American, or maybe a typical world citizen, that was getting my information from the media. And I didn't know about a gold heist, or I didn't know that Enron, Global Crossing, and WorldCom investigations were in Building 7 that fell down later in the afternoon after not being hit by an aircraft. And a lot of people don't even know that Building 7 fell down, or that Building 4 and Building 6 were destroyed as well.
That's right.
And so I tried to make the whole 9/11 story be presented to the person who maybe is starting to doubt and question. See, in the United States, we've got these news people now that have just been busted and caught lying and creating fake stories. And these are news presenters. They are
like Brian Williams, right?
Yeah. And Bill O'Reilly, the same on Fox. Yeah. And already Anderson Cooper, who apparently was once with the CIA. And it's interesting, too, as I've kind of been going through some of this stuff, as I've dug in and I found how many photographers and reporters are actually with the CIA and have been for a long time. I read an interesting book called On the Trail of the Octopus by Lester Coleman. It's actually banned in the United States. You can find it on the internet in a PDF. But he basically was a DEA agent and a DIA agent for the United States government in Cyprus. And that whole book is basically around something else I found connected to the 9/11 issue, Pan Am 103 and the heroin coming out of the Middle East. So that's a great book. I mean, I highly suggest if you want to read it. I read it in one night. So if you can, you know, have yourself some nice strong coffee and read it online on your computer, you can easily do it. And it's very informative. It's interesting. And then also, he actually started out himself in intelligence work as a photographer, journalist of some sort. So it's very, very prevalent. So when you see people getting their heads cut off, supposedly, in beheadings and that sort of thing from this new group called ISIS, for some reason, we find that ISIS just absolutely will not attack Israel. They're only attacking Christians and Muslims, but they're only less than a four-hour drive from Israel. So you got to wonder, and we've certainly left them with plenty of vehicles, and they have no problem getting the gas.
Well, did you see the recent one about U.S. aid stamps were even on the they've been getting supplies, resources, weapons, ammunition, all kinds of stuff.
Oh, yes. It's horrific. I have to tell you, once I got into really the deep research on 9/11, and it just keeps on going, I'm embarrassed to be an American at this point.
Well,
My husband and I are considering leaving.
It's not your guys' fault. I mean, it's like blaming the regular English person for the colonial empire, what they did or whatever. It doesn't apply. It's a kind of a misdirected sense of guilt, I think. Sure, there is a responsibility of course, trying to deal with the situation and regain control of the government. That I admit to. Mm-hmm. But I don't think individual Americans should feel guilty for something that they both don't know and also has been covered up and lied about, you know?
Yeah, that's true. I don't feel as much personal guilt as I do embarrassment, I guess, on the world stage that our company, that was a Freudian slip. Our government is run by huge corporations and they make money off war. And one of the things that I talk about in the methodical illusion, well, I talk about the New World Order. And I think a lot of people don't really understand the magnitude of what happened on 9/11. And when people say to me, well, why would you write about that? Such an old subject. I mean, it was 14 years ago. Well, what happened with 9/11 was such an orchestrated and methodically created an illusion as what it was. And it was so methodically created. However, the creators of the event did not, unfortunately for them, use a flight attendant as a consultant. And had they done that, they wouldn't have got caught. How I caught them and how I discovered where the aircraft and passengers and crews were taken and how it was done and how it was covered up was by my nearly 30-year airline training and experience. And so there were things that they just didn't know. And like I said, I mean, after I discovered all this, first off, I was in shock and I couldn't even continue writing. And then I thought, well, how am I going to deliver this? And would anybody care? Well, my book has been starting now the second month at the number one position in historical fiction on Amazon in the United States. I haven't looked and see where it is in UK or however it's done around the other parts of the world, but I know it's selling. And I've done autographed copies to lots of countries, probably a dozen different countries. And it's amazing to me that people are so interested in this, and they should be, because this is not just the future of the United States. The New World Order is basically the one world government that even is referenced in the Bible. It's worldwide communism and total tyranny, and we're all going to be sucked in on this. So it's really time people wake up and understand. And that really was the mission for me to write the book the way I did, was to help people understand, first off, how hard it is to wake up. My main character, the protagonist, her name is Vera Hansen. And she is a widowed flight attendant, senior flight attendant. And she had that fear of being labeled a tin hat wearer and a truther. And she refused to look. After some time in the book, she discovers that her husband, who had been killed in an accident, was actually a pilot for 9/11 Truth and involved big in the research into the whole 9/11 event. So she makes some discoveries and she starts coming out and leaving that fear of being labeled behind. And I know in the United States, on our television, I don't know about Europe because I haven't been over there for years, But here, if you question 9/11, or if you have from day one, if you've just questioned how did Building 7 fall down, I will never forget when I started this research, listening to a news channel, CNN or Fox News, just had it on while I was cooking or something, listening to see what was going on. And someone was questioning the Building 7 falling down at 5:20 in the afternoon, having not been hit by an aircraft or any residue, really, debris from the towers. And they were called an anti-Semite. And I went, what? Like, wait a minute. Okay, yeah. Wait a minute. Now, okay, a building falling down. Now, how do you get anti-Semitism out of this? And I really had not looked very deep at that point. I was just starting to look at this. I just discovered the hijackers were still alive. And I thought, well, that's the strangest thing I can imagine anybody saying. But that name calling, that pinhead, tinfoil hat, truther, those kind of things, that's a Saul Alinsky response from Rules for Radical. And that name calling thing is what my main character, my protagonist, was afraid of. She didn't want to look into 9/11. And I think a lot of us are like that. I think, and that's my target audience, I want people to understand that this was huge. It was complicated. There was millions of dollars in put options, stock options, insurance fraud, stolen gold, gold heist, Brady bonds that were expiring the next day worth $240 billion with a B dollars, wow. U.S. dollars. Yeah. And I mean, there were so many things. So what I did was I created a character and I wrapped up every truther I'd ever read about or seen their videos or talked to or listened to on a radio channel. And I created a character named Max Hager. And Max Hager he's a Vietnam vet, so he's a little bit older, but he's a lot wiser. And he is the truther's truther, and he delivers to the reader all of the things that went on that day so that if you got your information from the mainstream media, Max is going to wake you up to all of those things that went on. And he's got a character. Every man that reads his book wants to play him in the movie. I mean, everybody falls in love with Max Hager. He truly is the truther's truther. And so the reader actually wakes up with the main character as the 9/11 truth stuff is presented to her while she's in the middle of doing other research.
Now, let me ask you, I think this is always an interesting question because I think the biggest issue we're faced with here is not when it comes to the material that's available or, you know, any of those issues. There's just so much out there, as you said, available to people. The problem we're faced with is that people, one, either refuse to look at it or just simply don't have the interest or that spark within them that causes them to ask some of these questions, which is very unfortunate. But having said that, do you think that it's easier for people? We can make the comparison of the Da Vinci Code, for example. I mean, some of the subjects that he brought up in that book, I can't tell you how many people around me started talking about those issues just because they've read it in that book as opposed to when I talked about some of those ideas previously. So is it more of a psychologically perspective that this is a much an easier way entry into these kinds of subjects, do you think, if it's fiction?
Yeah, this is really the hot new way to introduce the truth to people. It's funny that you mentioned Dan Brown because just either yesterday or the day before on Amazon, I guess your readers can go to Amazon.com and read the reviews. Somebody just on Amazon in a review compared me to Dan Brown, which was totally awesome because I years ago studied all of the stuff that Dan Brown did on the history of the Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and mm-hmm. all of that aspect and back into the Knights of King Solomon's Temple and into the Illuminati and Freemason. And yes, it all does connect to the 9/11 stuff. Yes. And also Sybil Edmonds has written her latest book, is in a novel form. It is easier for people to see this. If you watched my book in a movie, you would probably walk out of that movie and just like reading the book, what I've discovered are people that are coming forward to me after reading The Methodical Illusion and saying, had I read this or heard an interview of you on the radio even 6 months ago, I wouldn't have believed it. But we have been lied to. This is a war machine this country's running. We have got to stop. And how can I help? How can we get involved? And people are waking up rapidly. And if this is a tool that helps, then, you know, so be it. I mean, this thing sat for 2 years in the corner of my room in about a 2-inch thick stack of manuscript. And I'd walk by it and think, oh, man, people will hate this. But that's not what happened. If people are reading it, they're waking up and they're thanking me for speaking out. And a lot of people wonder why other airline people haven't come forward. Well, they have come forward to me since the book has come out, and a lot of United and American pilots, retired and pilots that are still working, are actually buying the book direct from the publisher in quantity to hand them out. So most of them have come forward and read the book and said, you have figured this out. This is the missing piece of the puzzle. And there is no doubt exactly how I lay it out in the book, how it was done. And then I did find who did cover it up, and how that cover up was done, and how those companies got involved in United States national security computer systems. Mm-hmm. It's pretty frightening because they're still in there. They just changed the name of their company.
What are some of the big key elements that we need to discuss here, do you think?
Well, what happened for me was I started looking, just even, let's just take Flight 11, the first plane out. And as I'm reading through these FBI transcripts, I see that one of the flight attendants coined a few phrases in the transcripts. It's typed up by the FBI. She referred to the hijacker as a he, and she said this, he stood upstairs. And there are no stairs in a 767. They're only in the 747s. And so I thought, well, that's a weird thing. Why would she say that? And then she said this. She said, we're the first. And yes, indeed, they were the first of four aircraft that day. And then she said also that he has sprayed pepper spray or mace in the business cabin, and we can't breathe in business class. She's calling from her 3R jumpsuit, which is the very tail section of the double-aisled 767. It's a very large aircraft. And so she's about 155, 160 feet away from the action up there. I'm not sure how she knew what was going on. But let me just tell you this. My brain clicked right here. If you spray pepper spray or mace or some type of toxic tear gas type of gas like that in a pressurized cabin, everyone, including her, and she was on the phone for 27 minutes, and never coughed once, never mm-hmm. had her eyes. She never said to anybody, oh, this tear gas is so bad. It's even back here now. And it would be in a matter of about 3 minutes. And so if the aircraft was pressurized, and that's what took me, and I said to my husband, this girl just has been waiting for a flight attendant to hear what she just said. And my ears heard it. And I guess maybe if you weren't in the airline industry, and you hadn't had experience where someone sprayed cheap perfume even or broke a bottle of rum in business class, everybody on the aircraft is going to smell it in a matter of minutes. And if it's tear gas or pepper spray or mace or anything like that, it's going to be circulated through if the cabin is pressurized. And then when I saw that she said he stood upstairs, not only were they not pressurized, they were in a hangar, and every hangar has stairs. And they're usually in at least two, if not three, corners of the large hangar, depending upon which type of hangar it is and how large it is. And upstairs are always offices in a hangar. And so I realized right then and there that she put out a message that wasn't a threat to the handlers on board. There were not 19 Arab hijackers involved. I did find that 10 of them are still alive, and there are people that are much smarter than I am that are surmising that the other 9 were completely make-believe, just like I was going to do when I went to find a Middle Eastern character, and I was going to grab a first name from one and a last name from the other, which actually I did in the novel. So that is true. It's a true story. You can find out. I just grabbed a first name from one and a last name from another one, and that's exactly what the FBI did. And now, I also found that in the first 72 hours, the FBI originally claimed that there were 4 other people that were hijackers that were part of that 19 number they are sticking to. But unfortunately, 3 of those people showed up alive. They weren't hijackers. They hadn't been in Boston, Newark, or Washington, and they weren't involved in the hijackings. And they showed up in person at their local FBI or wherever. And one of them was an FAA aviation safety employee, even. And his brother, who the FBI claimed was on the passenger manifest in the first 72 hours after the event, the FBI claimed that these 4 people were there. 3 of them were alive, and one of them had been dead for a year. The FAA employee's brother had actually died in a small plane crash on September 11th, 2000. And so they actually quickly backpedaled, and a lot of people don't know that's written in a book by Paul Zaremba. And I found that really interesting as well. And that came out as I continued researching after The Methodical Illusion was written, because I can't stop now. I mean, I'm digging into some details now that are just phenomenal. And I have a terabyte of information from the Freedom of Information Act to go through, and just my own research and people that I believe were quote unquote handlers and were actually involved that day. So the things that popped up for me were like the pressurized cabin, the stairs, and then also on Flight 11, the two flight attendants were giving completely conflicting reports. One of them made a mistake that no flight attendant would ever make, ever. If your life depended upon this, you would never make this mistake. No flight attendant in the entire world would claim that an innocent passenger is the hijacker. And both of the flight attendants on Flight 11 referred to only one man, singular male, as a he, as the hijacker, until later on, then Amy Sweeney cooked up with, I don't know, she used a different number, 3 or 5 or something. But originally she called in and she said the hijacker was in 9B, seated in 9B in business class. Later on, she called back and said, oh, I made a mistake. The hijacker was in 10B. 9B had been killed or had been injured. And then later on killed. Well, I looked into who 9B was because I thought, well, that's a weird thing. Because listen, in the event of a hijacking, what would happen is we'll land the aircraft somewhere and some SWAT team, Navy SEALs or some FBI SWAT team, police SWAT team, somebody will liberate that aircraft. And if I told them that you were the hijacker and you really weren't, you probably wouldn't live to rebut my accusation. So it's not a mistake a flight attendant would make claiming that someone was a hijacker that wasn't. And so what I looked into about this passenger in 9B, I found very fascinating. He was actually a trained assassin for a foreign intelligence agency. He was also trained in anti-hijacking procedures and in hostage rescue. Those were his three specialties. He was involved in something that's called the Sayeret Mat Kol, which is a special forces unit of the Israeli Defense Forces, Mossad. And so we are led to believe that this man, I did a little research on him. It's really interesting because some of the stolen passports actually came from his hometown in the United States. He lived in Denver until he was 14, moved to Israel. When he was 18, he, of course, had to serve in the military, the Israeli Defense Forces, where they pulled him for the Special Operations Sayeret Mat Kol. I found the Sayeret Mat Kol very interesting because there's a couple other big players in the world stage that were also trained assassins. One of them just was at the United States Congress, Bibi Netanyahu. He's also a member of the Sayeret Mat Kol. And so was a gentleman who was, if you'll remember, on 9/11. He was in New York City the night before, and then he was in the BBC studios. He's the man who coined the phrase war on terror and was one of the very first individuals to tell the whole world that, in fact, this was done by Osama bin Laden from a cave in Afghanistan. And his name is Ehud Barak. He is also Sayeret Mat Kol, which means that these people are trained assassins. They are trained to kill people. And so we're led to believe, now I looked up a little bit about this 9B guy that we're supposed to believe was killed. He was fluent in English, Hebrew, and Arabic. So now we're led to believe that the people sitting behind him, the two hijackers who were planning the 9/11 event, this is the biggest event since Pearl Harbor. This actually was coined to the planners who planned it. They called it the new Pearl Harbor, and it really truly was. So here these two supposed hijackers are sitting in row 10A and B having a conversation right behind this guy's ears, not 2 feet behind his ears, is speaking in Arabic about their plan to take over the aircraft. He can hear them, and for no reason, they decide to jump up and stab him with a box cutter. If you can believe that, you're still under the veil. If you can start to wake up and see what nonsense that is, this character 9B, his friends in Israel, in the IDF, they said about him he could kill any human being with a pen and a credit card. And he was a businessman traveling, and he surely had a pen and a credit card on him. And if he was listening to these Arabs planning to hijack the aircraft, then you can tell me, figure out why he didn't do something about it and allowed himself to be killed. But originally, remember, he was pointed out as by an American flight attendant on Flight 11 as the hijacker. And I believe, in fact, he was a handler, most likely.
And again, you were just listening to the first part of an interview with author Rebecca Roth on redice.net out of Sweden. Rebecca's novel is called Methodical Illusion and came out in early 2015. She was being interviewed here by Henrik Palmgren. I also interviewed Rebecca Roth back in the winter, and that show is available on the website radioforall.net. And just a reminder, on September 9th, the Progressive Movie Night is back with the world premiere of the new film, Firefighters, Architects, and Engineers Expose the Myths of 9/11. And we're very fortunate to have architect Richard Gage, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, here at the event to introduce the film and answer your questions. So join us on Wednesday, September 9th at 7 p.m. in the Auerbach Auditorium in Hillier Hall on the campus of the University of Hartford. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Migrants, refugees, and workers unite in New York to demand open up the borders, provide safety, stop the violence, end the wars.
If you look at the plaque at the base of the Statue of Liberty, inscribed thereon by poet Emma Lazarus, are the words, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, your wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless tempest tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. The door is not open here for hundreds of thousands of migrants and refugees. The land of the free isn't something to be found at the American border or in New York Harbor. Rather, they have been risking life and limb. Migrants, refugees, life and limb to get into Europe." Recently, images circulated online of a drowned 3-year-old Syrian boy lying face down on a Turkish beach. The photograph, which many journalists and activists insisted be shown despite its graphic nature, was a stark reminder of the realities of a crisis that has gotten steadily worse.
Whether through small wars of destabilization or labor export programs, millions are displaced from their home countries to control markets, resources, territories, and extract super profits. With the drive for hegemony at the root, neoliberal economic policies and the mercenary armies are unleashed on countries in order to undermine and overturn economic and political sovereignties. While initially slow to rise to the occasion, New Yorkers are now rallying to demand justice.
Let's listen.
When refugee rights are under attack, what do we do?
Stand up, fight back!
When human rights are under attack, what do we do?
Stand up, fight back!
My name is Claudia. I'm with People's Power Assembly. Today marks the one-year anniversary of the disappearance of the 43 students from Ayotzinapa, Guerrero. They want us to believe that organized crime and corrupt public officials are responsible for the disappearance of the 43 students. We know that it's the state that disappears the students. It is the state that governs through disappearance, terror, and death of indigenous people and campesinos. Since 2006, over 30,000 people have been disappeared in Mexico as a result of the so-called war on drugs. This war is a farce. It is a way to increase repression against the people while pretending to fight against the narcos. In this war, the U.S. provides the money, the weapons, the training, and even some of the troops. This is not a war on drugs and on so-called organized crime. It is a war on the people of Mexico. The U.S. is a patron of this war, and the Mexican state is its accomplice. The true organized crime is created and maintained by the state and by the corporate interests who seek to expand their control over the people, lands, and resources of the Americas. This war has displaced us and millions of others, but crossing the border did not make us free. The deaths continue at the borderlands. The disappearances continue into detention centers and deportation centers, with over 2 million women, men, and children migrants kidnapped by the Homeland Security Forces in the U.S. under the Obama administration. As displaced Mexicans, we accuse the U.S. government, the banks, and corporate interests it represents of waging a war on Mexican people on both sides of the border. We call on all oppressed communities to follow the example of struggles for liberation and of historically colonized people who are fighting to dismantle the state and the organized crime systems it maintains.
Ayotzinapa vive!
La lucha sigue!
Ayotzinapa vive, vive!
La lucha sigue, sigue!
My name is Bernadette from the Campaign for People's Goals. Make some noise!
Woo!
What does forced migration even mean? Mothers have to leave their children behind to raise other people's children! That is what we mean by forced migration! We've built an alternative economic system that does not force parents to leave their children to spare them from poverty and hunger. Migration is an obligation! That is not the system we want for our world, is it?
No!
Until such time, these wars of destabilization stop! The refugee crisis will not stop! Are we going to stop these wars?
Yes!
That's what we mean by forced migration! If you only see this as a refugee crisis, if you only see it as immigration and not forced migration, you are not seeing the whole problem! If you do not see the whole problem, we cannot stop it! We need international solidarity! Our first speaker is the chairperson of the International Migrants Alliance, which is an organization that addresses the rights and welfare of migrants and refugees, Miss Annie Lestari.
To all the migrant workers, immigrant and refugee in the world, today is very important day to all of us, for the people and the migrants in the world, because there, inside the United Nations, many governments are gathering to approve what they call Sustainable Development Goals. It is the goals that is not meant for the peoples, that has been meant to promote
Jenny Lasari. Margaret Kimberly with UNEC, United National Anti-War Coalition. We're all here in solidarity together. We always speak of being against the wars at home and abroad. And these wars abroad force millions of people to leave their homes, their families, go to different parts of the world in desperation. Now we are seeing a horrible migrant crisis. People fleeing Libya, because Libya was destroyed in 2011 by imperialism, by the United States and NATO. People are fleeing Syria. Also since 2011, under attack, 9 million Syrians have been displaced around the world. Now it's considered a crisis because those people are going to Europe. It didn't seem to be a problem when they were in refugee camps in Syria and Lebanon and Turkey. But now the world is paying attention because they're in Europe. And they have humanitarian needs, obviously, but the biggest need they have is for the war to end in their homeland. The United States and Saudi Arabia have no right to say who should run Syria and destroy that nation. And that is why we are seeing this human suffering. But that's the cause of human suffering everywhere in the world. People in New York City come from all over the planet, but mostly because their countries have been impoverished by the policies of the wealthy nations. So we are here not just to say that migrants fleeing through Libya or fleeing through Syria or who drown on their voyage. By the way, people die getting here from Mexico. People die getting here from Central America. And obviously they need humanitarian support, but they also need for us to speak out against the policies which ruin their countries and endanger their lives. Power to the people.
Tell me what you want, what you really want.
Justice!
Tell me what you need, what you really need.
Justice!
How are we gonna get it?
People power!
Woo! We're gonna have Kasima Zin with Solidarity with Iran.
Woo! When we talk about refugees, Syria makes the largest of the refugees in the world. 4 million refugees registered with UN. Another 7 million have been displaced internally. More than half a population have been uprooted since 2011. 51% of the refugees is under 18 years old, and from that, 39% is only under 11 years old. U.S. imperialism, who caused all these refugee problems after the attack in the Middle East of all nations, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Afghanistan, and plan to attack Iran, cause all these refugees. USA only accepted 1,500 refugees. None of them were Syrian. Just imagine when we talk about capitalism, we talk about disaster. 60 million refugees caused by a country who only accepts 1,500 refugees. How can we analyze that? Only just 2014, 219 tried to cross the sea to Europe. And in first eight months of 2015, 300 people tried to cross the river. Only few of them were able to go. More than 4,500 was killed. They were killed on the way going to Europe. So I just tell that because the question of Syria is extremely important. We're going to be in solidarity with them, down with imperialism, down with capitalism, and long live the refugees, solidarity with the refugees. They have to be saved.
We are people. We are not illegal. We are people. We are not illegal. Que queremos justicia. Cuando,
ahora,
que queremos
justicia.
Cuando,
ahora,
que queremos
justicia.
Cuando,
ahora,
que queremos
justicia.
Cuando,
ahora.
Our next speaker is Terry Vallon with NAFCON.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm so proud to be here, thankful to be here with all of you. It's amazing to see so many different communities coming together. From the Middle East, from South Asia, from Africa, from our homeland in the Philippines, all across Asia and the Pacific. the Middle East, North Africa, all of our communities coming together. We're here in New York. I'm proud to join you all here when heads of state are gathered from around the world. But our people are forced to be here, forced to migrate from around the world to be here in places like New York. I'm here from San Francisco. Again, proud to join all of you at this gathering of people. And I was joined earlier. I was a juror on the International Tribunal of Conscience for the People in Movement. And so I'm proud to be part of that jury. Our brother Camilo, who spoke earlier, joined the International People's Tribunal on Human Rights Violations in the Philippines. And that's exactly what we've been doing across the United States. I'm the president of the National Alliance for Filipino Concerns, NAFCON, which is more than 30 organizations in over 23 cities across the country. Filipino forced migrants around the country are fighting for our rights against wage theft, for workers' rights, for immigrant rights, together with our brothers and sisters in the African-American community, in the Latino community, in the Palestinian community, in the Arab community, in all of the communities that make up this country. We've all been forced to migrate. The issues of gentrification today that we're fighting against in all of our communities, from New York to San Francisco, which I heard is even more expensive to live in than New York these days, so that gentrification against development, and the police repression that we face, the repression in our communities that's waging state violence and repression against our people in all of our communities in the United States, is what we're standing up against here. But through NAFCON in our Filipino community, we also have to talk about what's happening in our home country. NAFCON formed after September 11th, when immigrants' rights are now under Homeland Security, when U.S. troops were deployed to the Philippines, to the war on terror, the second front was in our homeland. The human rights violations that are being waged against our people in the Philippines, the same things that we heard in the International Tribunal of Conscience today of what's being waged against the people of Mexico. They're being forced to migrate across the border, they're being terrorized at the borders, and they're being devastated in their home country. The Ayotzinapa 43, the massacre in San Fernando, all of those disasters that we heard about are things that we're standing up together. Today, we hear about the tragedy in the Lumad communities across Mindanao. Philippine troops are taking over schools that are built for indigenous people in the Mindanao region of the Philippines. Indigenous people, Muslim communities, are being terrorized by Philippine police, Philippine military, and even U.S. troops and forces that are operating in Mindanao. We're standing up together against all these forces of oppression in our home countries, forcing us to migrate, standing up against the mining corporations, the deforestation, and the theft of our land and resources in our home countries. All we're fighting for is justice, for the right to determine our own self-determination and our own futures for ourselves, standing up against the UN and its plans for quote-unquote sustainable development goals. We need people's goals, the campaign for people's goals. We need to continue to stand together and fight for justice. So like that Spanish chant we said earlier, we're going to say, tell me what you want, what you really want.
Justice.
Tell me what you need, what you really need.
Justice.
How are we going to get it?
People power.
How are you going to get it?
People power.
How are we going to get it?
People power.
How are we going to get it?
People power.
Tell me what you want, what you really want.
Justice.
Tell me what you need, what you really need.
Justice.
Tell me what you want, what you really want.
Justice.
Tell me what you need, what you really need.
Justice.
How are you going to get it?
People power.
How are we going to get it?
People power.
How are you going to get it?
People power.
How are we gonna get it?
People power.
Now we have a brother from Nigeria. Please welcome Celestine Akpopari.
We may come from different continents and different countries, but we suffer the same thing. We have a common enemy. We will not want to leave our home to another country that has made us to leave our country to places where we can earn a living. Is not different from what you face. Ogoni used to be an oil-rich and efficient farming community, very rich. Before they discovered oil, the people started experiencing a decline in food production. They couldn't fish anymore because the river had been polluted with oil. And our people led a campaign against Shell because we survived by fishing and farming, and because of their profits, and had to raise a campaign against them. But because we did that, Shell, in collaboration with the Nigerian government, sent the military into Ogoni land, killing every human being they see. They arrested the leader of the Ogoni people, Ken Sarawiwa. He was executed by hanging with 9 other Ogoni people on November 10, 1995. What was the offense of Ken Sarawiwa? that your business, your profit-making business, is destroying our life and livelihood, and that you should go. Your Ogoni people is an indigenous ethnic nationality with a distinct culture and language, and we don't want to be slaves to anybody. We want to be on our own. They got to lose our land. We must come together and drive away this capitalism. A people united.
Our next speaker will share more about the refugee crisis from Serbia, Miloš Rajković.
Thank you. Sisters and brothers, there are so many struggles going on right now in the world and so many suffering that this is incredible. And here we are in the belly of the beast. Why am I mentioning this country? Because this is where, you know, the attack is happening on humanity. This is a disaster on all levels. And behind that, we know it's the NATO countries and the USA on the top of everybody else there. Now, the refugees are leaving and coming into different countries, including my own country, Serbia, getting through Hungary. Hungary closed the border. Now they went to Croatia from Serbia. Croatia closed the border and they are kind of fighting over it. NATO countries, all NATO countries that's participated in aggressions should be obliged to take the refugees in and to pay reparations. Greece, who is suffering from terrible financial dealings from the banks, they have 200,000 refugees right there. NATO should take all of these, and I wish all of us luck. There is a big struggles ahead of us on all levels, you know. Hopefully, you know, people of the world will be stronger and pull us into some bigger fights, because we have to fight. So good luck to all of us.
Rise up, rise up, rise up, rise up, my people, rise up. Rise up, rise up, rise up,
rise up, my people, rise up.
Our next speaker is another Filipino migrant worker to talk about the labor export policy in the Philippines, Jonah Bagles of Philippine Forum. I'm Jonah and I'm with Philippine Forum, and we're a migrants' rights organization based here in New York. As we gather here today at Washington Square, our heads of states and governments are also meeting today to plan for our future, where we, the people, don't have a say, where migrants like us are sold like goods and commodities in a market by our own governments inside the halls of the United Nations, who are not truly representing the voices of the people. Our own government, the Philippine government, has been so eager in pushing for the labor export policy, which has become a world-class model for exporting people. And today, in this current administration, the Aquino administration, more than 6,000 Filipinos leave the Philippines every day in search of jobs and better livelihoods elsewhere, which our government could not even provide. Instead of creating jobs at home, instead of creating national industries and implementing genuine agrarian reform, our government is busy meeting with other heads of states, crafting plans on how to further exploit us and make money out of our labor, our sweat and blood, and literally our lives. Is this the development that they are talking about? Is this what transformation and leaving no one behind means for our so-called world leaders? When we, the migrants, the export products that they are so proud of, are being abused, trafficked, killed, or become undocumented and vulnerable, get separated from our families, while we barely get any protection from our governments. Today, let us speak out and unite and let the world know that we, the people, do not approve of these development goals that the UN has been pushing for, goals that do not benefit the majority but only a few. We are migrants. We are workers. We are human beings. We are not for export, and we are rising up with the people. And forced migration.
And forced migration.
And forced migration.
And forced migration.
When the migrant workers' rights are under attack, what do we do?
Stand up, fight back.
What do we do?
Stand up, fight back.
We have our sister Kunsela Ilo with International League of People Struggle.
Solidarity with all migrants and refugees around the world who are crying out for justice. We're going to be marching from here to a cultural show in honor of the Tribunal of Conscience to remember the 43 students of Ayotzinapa and the tens of thousands of people in Mexico
who have been murdered because of neoliberalism, because of U.S. intervention. Some of you have traveled from around the world to condemn the United Nations for what it is responsible for. It is saying that they will leave no one behind with this post-2015 development agenda. What they're really saying is they will leave no one behind in their home country, because this development agenda is not for the people of the world. What is happening now in Syria? What is happening in North Africa, in the Middle East, and around the world? We are seeing wars of aggression that are displacing people, families, by the millions, where children and parents have to watch their family members drown in front of them because they are being forced to escape their homelands and seek a refuge. This is the crisis that we must confront. We must be bold and daring to take justice into our own hands. That means we need to take this imperialist system by the horns. That means we need to protest the United Nations and the heads of states that are justifying mass murder and mass displacement around the world. Here in the United States, there's also a war going on. We must connect the struggle for justice for the 43 to the struggle to demand that Black Lives Matter. This is not a coincidence that our people and our communities are under attack, because we are the ones who have the power to smash this system and make a better and socially just future for the rest of the world. We have to be united. So it is a beautiful thing for us to be together tonight, to unite and connect our struggles. And there is much more work to be done. We cannot stop now. We have to link our struggles around the world for our migrants and refugee families who have traveled from so far around the world to confront the heads of states here in New York City. We welcome you with open arms. We do say open the borders. We say stop all wars of aggression. Long live international solidarity.
Long live international solidarity.
Are we ready to march?
Yeah.
Are we ready to take the streets?
Yeah.
Long live international solidarity. Long live international solidarity.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
Equally reject new rights that are contrary to our values, norms, traditions, and beliefs. We are not gay.
I believe there should not be any criminal prosecution or infringement of people's rights on the basis of their sexual orientation. We don't have that.
We need to know our history, not have it tamed down and prettified like they're trying to do with Martin Luther King, or even erased as though we never existed.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Bali blasphemy charges follow a gay couple's Hindu cleansing. Mugabe and Putin misstate the obvious. And a Stonewall veteran keeps the spirit alive. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Kristen Million.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending October 3rd, 2015. An executive at the Four Seasons Resort on the Indonesian island of Bali is facing blasphemy charges for allowing a gay couple to hold a Hindu ceremony at the hotel. The story was widely reported as a gay wedding, but it was in fact a melukat, or Balinese karma cleansing ceremony. That explains the Hindu holy man in photos with a gay male Westerner and his local boyfriend. A police spokesman told Australia's News.com that 36-year-old Ni Niuman Mulyani is under investigation for selling the hotel's Hindu ritual package to the two men, even though she knew they were a gay couple. We have questioned some of the Hindu experts and found that the Hindu religion does not acknowledge same-sex couples, he said. The sales executive already knew the cleansing ceremony would be carried out by a gay couple, so it was a religious blasphemy. Bali is a popular wedding destination for Westerners, but Indonesian law defines civil marriage as exclusively heterosexual. The luxury five-star resort reportedly denied the same couple a wedding ceremony at the hotel in December last year, and the hotel's PR department issued an apology to Hindus this week for allowing the gay couple's cleansing ceremony. Blasphemy convictions in Indonesia, home to the world's largest Muslim population, carry a penalty of up to 5 years in prison.
The Isle of Man's government announced its support this week for a public consultation on a bill to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples. Same-gender couples in the autonomous British Crown Dependency have been able to enter into civil partnerships since April 2011. The Isle of Man only decriminalized homosexuality in 1992. Chief Minister Alan Bell told ITV that the island has come a long way since the dark days of the 1990s, and embracing this legislation would reflect our position as a progressive society that takes seriously the rights of vulnerable people and minorities. I believe that values of fairness and tolerance, he said, are shared by the overwhelming majority of people in our island. Following a favorable public consultation, which pundits say will be launched later this month, a civil marriage bill could be introduced in Parliament sometime next year.
There's a deep divide on the issue in Bermuda, according to the local Royal Gazette, but a first step may have been taken this week on the road to civil marriage equality there. More than 200 people packed an auditorium in the self-governing British Overseas Territory for a forum about opening civil marriage to gay and lesbian couples. It was organized by Community and Culture Minister Patricia Gordon-Pamplin, who praised the respectful dialogue. Most of the civil marriage equality opponents cited religious reasons, while some on the other side used the speaking opportunity to come out. Linda Meinzer of the Bermuda Public Services Union told the gathering that she's a law-abiding Christian and had always done what had been asked of her. "Now I'm asking something of you," she said. I want to get married in front of my people, my family, my friends, in a place where I have been raised. I don't want to leave my country to get married. The Gazette reported that her comments brought cheering supporters to their feet. She said she had suppressed who I am for 25 years. Asked when Bermuda's government might take action, however, the minister said only that the gathering had been aimed at starting a community dialogue and that the issue requires careful deliberation.
A marriage proposal on a Beijing subway was the talk of Chinese social media this week because it was a gay man kneeling in front of his boyfriend. Several commuters whipped out their smartphones to record the event, which was greeted with applause by many of the passengers and went viral almost immediately. Thousands have been talking about the proposal on the Twitter-like Weibo service using the hashtag Mid-Autumn Festival Man Proposes to His Boyfriend. On the video, the man is heard to say in his proposal, "Today I invite all the people we know and do not know to bear witness." And yes, so far as we know, the boyfriend said yes, although civil marriage is denied to same-gender couples in China.
In other news, Tunisia's justice minister called this week for repeal of the nation's law against private consensual adult gay sex. Mohamed Salah Ben Aissa was reacting to the highly publicized case of an unnamed 22-year-old student who was recently sentenced to a year in prison for violating Tunisia's sodomy law. He was arrested in early September after his phone number was found on the body of a male murder victim. He denied any involvement in the killing but confessed his relationship with the deceased to explain his connection to him. Authorities accepted his story after reportedly subjecting him to some type of medical examination to prove his homosexuality, although there's no scientific basis for any such exam, which can include a torturous anal probe. Police in the predominantly Muslim nation then handed him over to prosecutors because of his admission to having engaged in gay sex acts. The case has sparked outcry from both national and international human rights groups. Human Rights Watch Deputy Middle East and North Africa Director Eric Goldstein condemned the prosecution, saying that if Tunisia truly aspires to be a regional leader on human rights, it should lead the way in decriminalizing homosexual conduct. Consensual adult gay sex is currently punished in Tunisia by up to 3 years in prison.
New York City Irish LGBT activists have finally won a more than 25-year battle. The Lavender and Green Alliance will be allowed to march in the 254th edition of the city's annual St. Patrick's Day Parade next year under its own banner. The annual Roman Catholic organization-sponsored event draws more than 1 million tourists each year, but has long refused to allow self-identified LGBT groups to participate. Brendan Fay, founder of the Lavender and Green Alliance, said in a celebratory media statement this week that St. Patrick's Day, March 17, 2016, will be a great day for hospitality and inclusion. Irish Queers, a group that's protested the exclusion for more than two decades, also celebrated the decision in a blog post, saying that this is a victory for the grassroots organizing, civil disobedience, and street protest of the Irish lesbian and gay organization and its successor, Irish Queers. An LGBT employee group did march under the NBC Universal corporate banner this year, but reportedly only because NBC was the event's broadcast TV partner. Parade organizers have been under increasing pressure to end the parade's ban on self-identified LGBT participation, with more and more corporate sponsors pulling out or threatening to, and many New York City politicians, most recently Mayor Bill de Blasio, boycotting the parade because of the exclusion. Parade Board Chair John L. Leahy said in his group's media statement that since 2016 marks the 100th anniversary of the Easter Rising, considered the birth of Irish independence, the St. Patrick's Day Parade, March 17th, is a special opportunity for renewed commitment to Irish values and traditions and the Irish role in the 21st century. We are working with the Government of Ireland in this anniversary year, he added, to teach our young people the lessons of sacrifice and heroism, of love and tolerance embodied in the Irish spirit.
And finally, we bid a belated farewell to a U.S. baseball legend who is also, you may not have known, an LGBT ally. Yogi Berra, for whom the cartoon bear was named, passed away last week at the age of 90. The venerable New York Yankees catcher and perennial All-Star was probably best known for his prowess on the field and his unique use of the English language, such as, "It was like deja vu all over again." But less known were his contributions to the LGBT community. He became an ambassador for Athlete Ally in 2013, a group that partners with professional, college, and Olympic athletes to advance LGBT equality. Under his leadership, the Yogi Berra Museum and Learning Center in Little Falls, New Jersey, presented an exhibit titled Championing Respect, highlighting athletes like Jackie Robinson, who've contributed to social change, and specifically including Billie Jean King and those working for LGBT equality. Center Director Dave Kaplan told the New York Times earlier this year that, "You don't usually see guys like Yogi at gay pride parades, but when I explained to him that this is the equivalent of the civil rights movement, people looking for equal opportunity and respect, he said, I have no problem with that. If they can play, they can play."
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 3rd, 2015. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Kristen Millian.
And I'm John Dyer V.
It's always Stonewall time, and that's a reason to sing later in the program.
Up behind the bus stop in the toilets of the street, there are traces of a killing on the floor beneath your feet. Mixed in with the piss and beer are bloodstains on the floor from the boy who got his head kicked in a night or two before.
Homophobia, the worst disease. You can't love who you want to love in times like these. Homophobia, the worst disease. You can't love who you want to love in times like these.
The presidents of two countries doubled down on their homophobia and denials this week. Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe has chalked up an infamous record of anti-gay statements and policies. So his remarks on the subject at this week's United Nations General Assembly meeting were not surprising, though he apparently failed to notice the chuckles from the audience.
Nowhere does the Charter arrogate the right to some to sit in judgment over others. In carrying out this universal obligation, in that regard, we reject the politicization of this important issue and the application of double standards to victimize those who dare think and act independently of the self-anointed prefects of our time. We equally reject attempts to prescribe new rights that are contrary to our values, norms, traditions, and beliefs. We are not gays. Cooperation and respect for each other will advance the cause of human rights worldwide. Confrontation, vilification, and double standards will not.
Russian President Vladimir Putin discussed his country's supposedly unbiased treatment of LGBT people with reporter Charlie Rose in a web-posted outtake from this week's CBS News program 60 Minutes.
In America, the Supreme Court declared it a constitutional right for same-sex marriage. You think that's a good idea?
Вы знаете, это неоднородное...
Well, I think that's not a homogeneous group of people. Some representatives of the non-traditional sexual orientation, for example, are against the adoption of children by such couples. They themselves are against it. So do you think these people are less democratic than those who support child adoption by gay couples? Most likely not. But that's simply their take on the issue. The problem of sexual minorities in Russia had been deliberately exaggerated from the outside for political reasons, I believe, without any good basis.
Okay,
help us understand.
Well, I'll explain it for you. It's well known that in four states in America, homosexual orientation is a crime. Whether it's good or bad, we don't know. We know there's the ruling of the Supreme Court, but this problem has not completely disappeared. It's not completely removed from American legislation, but we don't have that.
So you would condemn that?
I definitely condemn that. I believe there should not be any criminal prosecution or any other prosecution or infringement of people's rights on the basis of their race, ethnicity, religious or sexual orientation. We don't have that. If my memory doesn't fail me, we had Article 120 of the Criminal Code in Soviet Russia, which had prosecutions on the basis of homosexuality. We've abolished all of that. We have no persecution at all. People of non-traditional sexual orientation work, they live in peace, they get promoted, they get state awards for their achievements in science and arts or other areas. I personally have awarded them medals, but we have a ban on gay propaganda aimed at minors. I don't see anything undemocratic in this legal act. I believe we should leave kids in peace. We should give them a chance to grow, help them to realize who they are and decide for themselves. Do they consider themselves a man or a woman, a female, a male? Do they want to live in a normal, natural marriage or a non-traditional one? That's the only thing I wanted to talk about. I don't see here any infringement on the rights of gay people.
So you're saying that, as far as you're concerned, there is as much a recognition for gay rights and gay marriage as there is in the United States. That's your position.
We not only recognize, but we ensure their rights. In Russia, there are equal rights for everyone, including for people of non-traditional sexual orientation as well.
The most recent evidence of the kind of equality that reigns in Vladimir Putin's Russia includes a prominent politician's announcement of a new multinational organization committed to ridding the world of LGBT people and the banning of five LGBT online youth groups. But one of those groups, Children 404, found a way to survive and now has more active members than ever. While the truth and fiction of the Stonewall Rebellion has been a hot topic lately, a proposal to honor the actual historic site is gaining steam. Gay USA TV co-host Andy Hum attended a recent press conference on the plan and told co-host Ann Northrup what happened when an original Stonewall activist went Stonewall.
There is this big movement that was started by something, a private group called the National Parks Conservation Association. We have their website because they've got a petition to the president to make Stonewall, the area outside Stonewall, primarily...
Outside the Stonewall Bar.
Yeah, primarily the park, Christopher Park, a little vest pocket park there, a national monument. They want the president to use the Antiquities Act to declare it a national monument. Now, Kirsten Gillibrand, the senator from New York, Jerry Nadler, the congressman, they're introducing legislation in the Congress to do this because that's the other way to do it. I heard this referred to on the news as the only way to do it. That's not true. The president can do it, and you can sign the petition at their website, ncpa.org. Martha Shelley, who was a Stonewall participant, now there's this press conference with all these officials, and she gives this radical speech, linking all the issues. It was eye-popping, and it was totally appropriate for the occasion. I mean, why bother remembering the Stonewall if you're not going to keep its spirit alive?
Exactly.
I'm Martha Shelley, and I was one of the founders of Gay Liberation Front. We're in at the Stonewall Inn today because of the riot that took place around these premises back in 1969. Before then,
gay people had to keep the most central part of our souls hidden in shame. And now we might have a national park celebrating our struggles. This is terribly important because we need to know our history, not have it tamed down and prettified like they're trying to do with Martin Luther King, or even erased as though we never existed. So here's some of that history. The Stonewall Riot wasn't the first of its kind. The first that I know of occurred in 1966 at Compton's Cafeteria in San Francisco. What's special about Stonewall is that some of us seized the opportunity to form the GLF, the National Gay Liberation Front. Up to 1969, the existing gay organizations were assimilationist. They aimed to convince America that all gays wanted was acceptance into middle-class society. They were well-dressed and polite, and they got almost nowhere. GLF was a coalition of radical gays from the mainstream organizations, gay radicals from socialist organizations, and street queens and dykes who'd never been organized before. We forged alliances with other groups that shared our dreams of a just society, like the Black Panthers and the Women's Liberation Movement. At one point, we put together a list of demands. These included the right to control your own body, which meant freedom to engage in consensual sexual activity, reproductive rights for women, freedom to get high, and freedom not to have your ass drafted and shipped to Vietnam. Our demands included an end to racist oppression. They included economic justice. We are here today because the in-your-face tactics of Gay Liberation Front, Gay Activists Alliance, and ACT UP succeeded, at least to a certain extent. We have same-sex marriage. We can now volunteer to have our openly gay asses blown up in the Middle East. America may be on the road to ending the drug war, but every day we read about the cops murdering another unarmed Black or Hispanic person and getting away with it. Our jails and prisons have become a vast gulag for poor minorities. Abortion rights are being slashed, and women are still treated like baby-making machines in a lot of this country. Economic inequality is astronomically worse. Ordinary workers have lost their jobs, their homes, and their pensions, while CEO pay is somewhere between 700% and 1,000% greater than it was in 1969. And the filthy rich, I do mean filthy, want us to keep burning fossil fuels so they can pile up more money while the planet goes down. Let's pause for a moment today because we need to celebrate our victories, but only for a moment. And then let's all of us, especially you young people, get out in the streets and organize.
So was there, did the officials say anything?
They laughed nervously while this was, they kept their smiles on because this was a happy occasion. We're going to make it a park. And Martha was just fierce. She lives in Portland, Oregon now.
Thank you, Martha.
Martha Shelley's blast at a press conference announcing the new Stonewall commemoration proposal was discussed by Andy Hum and Ann Northrup of Free Speech TV's Gay USA. And finally, in this week's installment of The Trials of Clerk Kim Davis, Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear's lawyers have asked a judge to dismiss a lawsuit by the Rowan County official who spent 5 days in jail for refusing to issue marriage licenses to same-gender couples. Court filings called Davis' arguments absurd, forlorn, and obtuse. Davis lost her new BFF when the Vatican disavowed her lawyer's claim that Pope Francis had blessed her efforts in a secret, private meeting. And then what could be the best parody of her story yet took YouTube by storm.
Going to the chapel and we're gonna get get married.
I just want you all to know that we are not issuing marriage license today.
Why?
Pending.
What appeal is left?
Pending the appeal in the Sixth Circuit.
What's the appeal in the Sixth Circuit?
Has been denied.
Right. The injunction is the order that you're supposed to issue marriage license.
And we're not issuing marriage license today.
The Supreme Court denied your stay.
We are not issuing marriage licenses today.
So based on what?
I would ask you all to.
Why are you not issuing marriage licenses today?
Because I'm not.
Under whose authority?
Whose authority?
Under God's authority.
Just keep pressing. Don't back down. We are a strong people. I am the very model of a modern fundamentalist. I'm not merely judgmental. I'm the absolute judgmentalist. I always follow scripture and I act on God's authority. Though marital fidelity was never my priority. I married first one husband, then two others, then another one. Because I think one man is pretty much like any other one. I've never been too troubled by legalities of sex outside of marriage or of other trivialities. Yeehaw! But when it comes to icky stuff like homosexuality, I'm always very strident with my Puritan morality. In short, in matters biblical and spiritual and Calvinist, I am the very model of a modern fundamentalist.
In short, in matters biblical and spiritual and Calvinist, she is the very model of a modern fundamentalist.
In questions of behavior, I fall back on my Old Testament, for saying no to shrimp is way too much of an impediment. I simply pick the verses that support my ideology and hold on fast and true to my intolerant theology. I'll ride this hobby horse until I'm richer than a sybarite. There'll always be good money in denouncing godless sodomites. I'll put my name as author on some books that I can barely read. And get a show on cable to inform the world what God decreed. My husbands all agree that I know more about what marriage is than five Supreme Court justices whose law my faith disparages. In short, matters biblical and spiritual and Calvinist, I am the very model of a modern fundamentalist.
In short, matters biblical and spiritual and Calvinist, she is the very model of a modern fundamentalist.
Perhaps if I learn what is meant by constitutionality, if I could do my job with requisite impartiality, oh, if I could join in marriage to young men who might be thespians, or issue nuptial licenses to enterprising lesbians. If I could see that love is love, no matter what the sexes are, and understand that gays are just like me and my three exes are. In short, if I could finally get a dose of moral clarity, oh, I'd find out what is meant by the idea of Christian charity. Nah. Till then, I'll flaunt the law and draw my wages from the treasury and grab a photo op with my next husband, Michael Huckabee. Till then, it matters biblical and spiritual and Calvinist. I'm the very model of a modern fundamentalist.
The lyrics for Modern Fundamentalist to the Gilbert and Sullivan tune were written by James F. Trum. The YouTube video starring Rena Strober was produced and arranged by Jeff Hoppner and directed by Richard Kraft. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Kristen Mellion and John Dyer V contributed program material, with thanks, as always, to Steve Pride, Chumbawamba, Sly and the Family Stone, the Tom Robinson Band, Survivor, and Reba Stober performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org, on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher, and on KRZA, Alamosa, Colorado, WMBR, Cambridge, Massachusetts, CJLY, Nelson, British Columbia, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Today on Against the Grain, is equality possible? James Martel says that political equality is a very rare thing, but he believes the experience of anarchism in early 20th century Spain demonstrates that equality is a real possibility. I'm C.S., the San Francisco State political scientist, joins us to discuss equality and anarchist practice, past and present, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. What can the Spanish experience of anarchism in the 1920s and 1930s teach us? Well, perhaps the first question that must be answered is, what was that experience? What did the Spaniards who practiced anarchism before and until their experiment was brutally crushed, what did they do and how did they think? James Martel, a professor of political science at San Francisco State University, decided he would investigate both that experience and the lessons it offers for today. His research was motivated by a perception that we have come to see inequality as inevitable, as an unavoidable fact of life. As we'll see, the Spanish anarchists definitely did not share that perspective. James Martel's interests include political theory, continental philosophy, and theories of gender and sexuality. His books include Textual Conspiracies, Walter Benjamin, Idolatry and Political Theory, and How Not to Be Governed, Readings and Interpretations from a Critical Anarchist Left, which he co-edited. When James Martel joined me in studio, I asked him what drew him to the Spanish anarchists of the 1920s and up through the Spanish Civil War that ended with the victory of Francisco Franco's forces in 1939.
Well, I myself am an anarchist, so I just feel that kind of affinity with them because a lot of the issues that they struggled with are issues that I feel are still important issues that we have to work out politically. And the thing that really excites me about the Spanish anarchists in particular is that they had the most extant and successful anarchist project probably ever. so that when you really want to look at how anarchism actually works, I know currently there's scores of anarchist communities, hundreds of who knows how many all over the world practicing anarchist politics right this minute. But in terms of the large scale extant anarchist practices, they're the ones to look at, and so we can learn a lot from their experience.
And how long would you say anarchism in this particular time period before and during the Spanish Civil War lasted? I mean, is there any way to define a certain temporal boundary to that project?
It's hard to say. The roots of anarchism in Spain start in the 19th century, but I think it's in the 20th century that it really gets going. And it really is the 20s and the 30s that are the period in question. And it ended quite decisively with the defeat by the fascists at the end of the Spanish Civil War. So it definitely has an end date. Although, of course, anarchism didn't go away in Spain, and there's anarchists today. But the project that I'm interested in was very definitively ended and very violently.
This project of yours was inspired by the work of the philosopher Walter Benjamin. How so?
Well, Walter Benjamin never called himself an anarchist. He always called himself a communist. But my reading of his work is that he is very anarchist, not only in kind of his political prescriptions, but also even in the way he writes. He's very concerned not to sort of dominate as an intellectual with his like privileged perch where he can look down on the rest of the world. He's very interested in kind of opening up his perspective and his way of thinking and drawing the reader in as a much more active participant in the way he writes. And so I think of him as being anarchist all the way down. He's politically, linguistically, even theologically anarchist. And so I think the upshot of a lot of his politics is anarchist. And he actually speaks about anarchism all the time, despite the fact that, as I said, he called himself a communist all of his life.
And he also juxtaposed, and I know you're especially interested in this, he juxtaposed different eras, different periods of time. Why did he do that, and what did he think we could accomplish by doing that?
Well, one of the very last things that he wrote, Theses on the Philosophy of History, is a very well-known essay by him in which he sort of deals with the despair that he felt that, you know, it was written in 1940 and fascism was coming fast and furious, or was there, and he just sort of wanted to deal with the kind of despair that the left felt at that time, that they were felt like at a dead end, that, you know, that communism was, you know, had sort of gone bad in Russia and the fascists were triumphant. And so he really looked to the past, and he always looked to the past as a source not just of solace, but also of revolutionary potential, because in his view, the past is never gone and dead. It's still active. It's still actively related to the present in a very dynamic way. And one of the things that he fought most earnestly against was the idea that time itself brought some kind of progress or teleology, and so that if you were in the future, you were therefore more advanced than if you were in the past. He completely denied that, and he didn't think that one temporal moment had any kind of privilege over another. You could say, and I love this about him, he anarchizes time itself, so that time isn't, you know, sort of building up towards a better thing. It's every moment in time is just as good as every other moment in time, and therefore he could look back to time for both inspiration and sort of actively to sort of activate moments in the present by connecting them together. My project is a little bit inspired by that, so I'm thinking about going back to the 1930s in Spain as a way to activate our time, which itself I think is a very anarchist moment, and very excitingly so.
And here are you referring to Occupy Wall Street and Tahrir Square and other very visible social movements and moments?
Absolutely. You know, I would also include Black Lives Matter, a lot of even more contemporary stuff than that. But absolutely, yes. I mean, these movements have all been, to some extent, consciously anarchist. And I think what's exciting about our time period is that anarchism is kind of the operating model that the left turns to almost automatically these days, which I think is a very good thing.
You also draw inspiration from what the French philosopher Alain Badiou calls singularities. What are they?
These are moments in time when something that was before was completely impossible suddenly becomes possible. So he has this view that there's certain moments, he ultimately calls them events, where something emerges out of impossibility into possibility, sort of by its own sheer force of coming into being. And then it changes the world forever. So his examples are the Paris Commune, the Chinese Cultural Revolution, the late 60s in Europe. These kind of moments are, for him, change the world forever, and the forces of reaction can never put the genie back in the bottle once whatever emerges. And so that's kind of one way of looking at history, that's also very anti-teleological and not just, you know, Hegelian, where everything just moves towards its perfect end.
And you want to, I think, expand the term singularity to include a certain time period in history.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't think Bajou would be against that either. But I would definitely like to add the Spanish experience of anarchism to that list as radically changing what was thought to be possible in the world and making new political possibilities available.
There's a lot of inequality out there today, and a lot of actual debate and attention has been applied to the fact of inequality. I wonder if you could talk about how you understand inequality, what facets of inequality you would point to. Let's start there.
Well, I mean, I think there's many different kinds of inequality. There's obviously economic inequality, which is growing in leaps and bounds. But there's another kind of inequality that I'm very interested in, which is political inequality. And what I mean by that specifically is I think people are politically unequal if they don't have an active and ongoing say in their own political life. And I think in the United States, we have a model where you vote for somebody once a year and then you go back into complete political obscurity and have absolutely nothing more to do with your political life. So to me, that's political inequality. I don't see representational government as giving you any kind of active engagement in your political life. And so a model like anarchism is much more able to allow you to be an active participant in these kind of decisions and in this kind of life.
A number of people on the left would probably say that socialism and communism and anarchism, they are all in some way devoted to political equality, to true political equality. Would you agree with that?
I would in theory. I think in theory they all are. But I think the reason I'm an anarchist and not a socialist or a communist is because I think that anarchism holds that belief much more fundamentally and isn't willing to ever compromise it. And I think that's something that really distinguishes them. So that, you know, it goes back to Marx and the Communist International, the whole idea of whether you take over the state and use the state for a while to defeat, you know, capitalism and inequality, or rather you allow that to happen through worker councils and that and sort of more decentralized forms of organization. I firmly am on the anarchist side on that question. I think if you leave the state intact, you bring on endless problems and you end up defeating your revolution. And that's exactly what happened during the Spanish Civil War.
James Martel joins us in studio on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. James teaches political science at San Francisco State University. Well, maybe we should get a definition of anarchism out there. I mean, obviously, it's hard to encapsulate. It's a very big idea with a big tradition, but how would you try and define it in a nutshell?
It is hard to define, and there's a million varieties. That's one of the problems with anarchism. You get 10 anarchists, you get 10 different kinds of anarchism. But I think the way I would try to define it is anarchism is a political and economic system in which each person both lives by and suffers from the consequences of their decisions. So that if you make a political or an economic decision as part of like a larger collective, you get the payoff and the consequences of that decision, and you suffer and enjoy things accordingly. And there's no one else above you or, you know, sort of mediating that kind of experience for you.
Right. So there's a definite hostility, a distinct hostility toward hierarchy, toward all forms of authority?
Hierarchy, yes. All forms of authority, not necessarily. I think there are ways, and this is something the anarchists experimented with in Spain, there are ways to have authorities and kind of even centralized nodes, but the difference was those centralized units always had to refer back to the local and the decentralized specific units for their instructions. So there was authorities, but they weren't authorities in the sense that they are in our country, where they just authorities mean they just tell you what to do. These were always two-way streets at best, and if anything, they were maybe just received instructions from below.
So George Orwell, he wrote a famous book called Homage to Catalonia, which details what Orwell observed and experienced in Spain during the Spanish Civil War in the mid-1930s. He actually went to Spain as a journalist, and he ended up fighting for the socialist side. What did Orwell observe when he visited anarchist Barcelona, revolutionary Barcelona?
what his description is a city where all the kind of traditional hierarchies were gone, where people used tu to each other instead of the formal usted, where people wore workers' clothes, where all the kind of trappings of, you know, class were missing, and even the rich were sort of dressed like poor people because they wanted to fit in. And it was just a radically different kind of climate than anything that you or I have ever experienced. He called it a queer and moving experience to be there. He wasn't sure what he thought about it, but he was very, very moved by the sort of genuine expressions of classlessness that he saw all around him. And it was so unusual that he was moved to write about it because it was something he had never seen before. And I don't think we see much of that in our time either.
Yeah. And so what did you find so striking about his characterization of what he observed as queer and moving?
I think it just sort of spoke to the way that all of us have so internalized class divisions that we're not even aware of it. I think, you know, we live in a society that's so permeated by class, even though the American story is everyone is middle class. But I think we're so used to what people call microaggressions of class, where, you know, sort of deferring to higher class and aspiring to be a higher class. And everything is just sort of organized by class consciousness and class desires. And everybody wants to be rich. You know, that kind of model is so normal for us, and also for Orwell in England of his time, that to have an alternative be present and lived and actual is really just almost miraculous from our current. It seems like right now that we couldn't imagine such an alternative universe, and I think a lot of people just don't even think that that's possible. But so to actually experience it physically the way Orwell did, and then to write about it and to express that into our times is just a wonderful way to show us that our understanding of what's possible is extremely limited and really determined by our internalized class consciousness that we don't even realize we have.
What kind of research did you do in order to try and find out and grasp what political equality, which you're very interested in, of course, looked and felt like in anarchist Spain?
So far, I've mostly limited myself to reading anarchist newspapers from the period. And, you know, I was concerned that they were going to be very propagandistic. And to some extent, some of them were, especially the kind of the bigger journals like Tierra y Libertad, which was one of the CNT's, the anarchist union's big mainstream papers. However, even in those papers, when I compared it to the communist and socialist papers of the time, they were much less propagandistic. They were much more frank and candid. And I think that kind of reflected a different organizational structure that those papers used, that they, you know, they actually had much less paid staff and people that were actually also workers. So they didn't have this kind of elite. They didn't always have this kind of elite journalistic kind of mentality. So I tried to look at these papers and try to find not only look at the front sections where they're talking about the news, but just sort of look into the back parts of the paper just to look for essays that just kind of conveyed a kind of a sense of the actuality and the experience of anarchism in that period. And also the way that they contended with and struggled with lots of issues that anarchism needed to work out.
What about people writing about political theory and trying to theorize what was happening and where it came from? Were you equally interested in that?
I wasn't. You know, I'm a political theorist myself, and all of my work usually is just political theorists doing that. But this time I wanted to stay away from that because this is very much inspired by Walter Benjamin. I wanted to get away from a kind of an academic or an elite level perch and just kind of try to immerse myself into like a much more ground level kind of a view. And the access to that were these anarchist journalists who were themselves, you know, activists and part of the organization and part of the daily life in these places, you know, especially in Catalonia. So I wanted to sort of avoid theory as much as possible.
So, I mean, one way one might characterize this Spanish anarchist experiment is to say that it was continuous, that it was anarchist from start to end, and it was a bloody end. And you like to refer to the Spanish anarchism of this time as piecemeal and episodic. Elaborate on that.
Well, that was something that really struck me very clearly in the way that they wrote. The anarchist journalists that I read were much more comfortable with a kind of anarchism that was neither territorially nor temporally continuous. And I think that really reflects a radically different orientation, politically speaking, because when you live under what I like to call archism, which is whatever anarchism isn't, which is state-oriented and all of that, archism demands territorial continuity and temporal continuity. Everything has to sort of be whole and everywhere all at once. And that's really a kind of a key element of sovereignty because it demands to be absolute within its territory and over the time span of the life of that state. Whereas the anarchists didn't seem to have that obsession, and that also struck me as being very unusual and remarkable, exactly because it's so different than what we think of as normal. So that they would talk about, you know, anarchist collectives that were side by side to other, you know, non-anarchist collectives, and that was fine, and maybe there wasn't even a continuous territorial path from one anarchist collective to another, but they kind of all knew each other. And similarly, over time, the way that anarchism kind of flickered in and out over the 20 years in question, or even more in Spain, you know, sometimes the anarchists were ascendant, and they certainly were after 1936. But before that, there was like dark periods and good periods. And even so, there was no insistence on this kind of continuity that they had to kind of dominate all the time. They were much more connected across periods of time, across chasms where anarchism wasn't really prevalent. And they could sort of connect to earlier periods in a way that I think is very consistent with the way that Walter Benjamin thinks about time as well. So I find that very interesting.
Do you think that sentiment was motivated in part by a sense that, you know, they didn't think anarchism could really take over the countryside and the urban areas in the way they wanted, and so they were going to be happy with whatever they achieved?
That's an excellent question. I think that's a poignant question, because one of the things that really ultimately hurt the anarchists was their reluctance to do what you just said. In other words, they didn't want to take over. They wanted that to happen much more organically. Unfortunately, they had as competition the Communist Party, who absolutely wanted to take over and did everything in their power to push the anarchists out. So there was a point when, right after the fascist coup in 36, that the anarchists in Catalonia took over the entire province and a little bit of the neighboring province of Aragon. And then they thought, well, now what do we do? Do we just declare ourselves in charge? It was the CNT, the large anarchist union. They said, do we put ourselves in charge and just kick out the Generalitat, which is the Catalonian political authority, and just, you know, forget the republic and all that? Many people wanted to do that, but ultimately they decided not to for various reasons. And I think that reluctance actually ended up hurting them. So I think you're right. They didn't think they could or should take over, but that ended up being a weakness that was cruelly exploited by their erstwhile allies.
One journal article you found describes a large anarchist land cooperative called Enadas. And I think you began talking about it to the degree that you were saying that, you know, they would accept the fact that there might be an anarchist collective among non-anarchist forms of operation and organization. What else did you find striking about this article?
I just found in that article and many others, there's just kind of a joy and amazement among the writers that this was actually working. Because I think all these people, too, had grown up in the same norms that you and I have, that these kind of things shouldn't be possible, that this kind of that you need management and you need hierarchy and you need bosses and you need all that stuff to work, and they didn't, and it was working, and I thought they were ecstatic about that and tried to express that kind of joy. That's one of my favorite things about reading about these anarchist collectives, was that they were just ceaselessly amazed that they were actually working.
And they also saw anarchism in the smallest details.
That's true. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, down to every single level of lived experience, there was a way to anarchize everything. And one thing that I think is really critical and important, and this is something that I get from Walter Benjamin, is something that you could call the anarchism of everyday life. Because Walter Benjamin says that we act as anarchists all the time. Like, we make all kinds of decisions without recourse to states and hierarchies, you know, every day. And so in a way, what the anarchists in Spain were doing wasn't kind of inventing something whole out of whole cloth. They were actually allowing the kind of anarchist practices that they always practiced to remain undetermined, as well as adding other practices that are usually determined to those practices. So it wasn't like a utopia where they were just starting over. They actually, the large parts of human life are anarchists already. But they were just using that as a base by which to build upon and expand to anarchize more rather than less.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. James Martell is his name. He's professor of political science at San Francisco State University. And his books include Textual Conspiracies, Walter Benjamin, Idolatry and Political Theory, and How Not to Be Governed, Readings and Interpretations from a Critical Anarchist Left, which he co-edited with Jimmy Casas Clausen. So anarchists did organize. They joined organizations. They formed organizations, sometimes very large organizations. And one thing you're interested in the paper that we are addressing is how organizational conduct and requirements, how that fit with the anarchist way of life, the kind of anarchist principles that emphasize individualism, for example. Can you go into that for us?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the most critical areas that the anarchist had to deal with, which was how to maintain their sort of philosophical orientation into actual practices and actually run large factories and large farms and so on. The concern was that they really compared themselves to the communists, who would nationalize things, so that when the communists would take something, they would turn everything over to like a hierarchy, like a communist party or the state or whatever, and then they would run everything centrally. I think what the anarchists tried to practice was something you could call decentralized planning instead of centralized planning. They wanted to have organization, and the idea that anarchism and organization are antithetical is just a liberal fantasy, a very annoying one, by the way. anarchists are as organized as everyone else. In fact, they're far more organized because everyone is involved in the organization instead of just the sort of top-down model where there's organizers and then everybody else. But they were very concerned with a certain level of voluntarism, that people weren't forced to do jobs they didn't want to do. And they also had to deal with the problem that elite-level training sometimes demanded special treatment, like with doctors and engineers and professionals like that. One of the moves that the anarchists tried to put was to have a single salary for everybody. There was only a couple places where they actually did this. But, you know, everyone would get the same salary because they really believed in that Marxist adage, you know, from each according to their ability to each according to their need. So you weren't working for money. You were working to be part of the society. So doctors and engineers, though, would sort of demand more money, and then they would get into these kind of problems about that. And, you know, I think they would still radically underpay the doctors by normal standards, but they still would overpay them by their own standard, which is that no one should get any more money than anybody else. So they did come across these kind of problems, and they always alternated between trying to sort of impose what they thought as right and at the same time try to work with what people wanted to do because of that reluctance to be like communists and just make everything the way that they thought it should be. So that was always an ongoing issue for them. I love the way the CNT ran itself, which is this huge anarchist organization with hundreds of thousands, millions of members. They only had, I believe, just a very few, very small number of paid staff, like maybe two or three people. Everyone also worked at their job, and then they had to rotate really quickly. They could only have this position for like a year or so, so they were very reluctant to allow any kind of professional class to develop. So they were always kind of circulating people in and out of the work life and connecting them to working very conscientiously. So, I mean, the other unions couldn't believe this. You know, other unions had these paid professionals who, like, you know, became their own kind of fat cats and did whatever. But the anarchists really stayed true to this. And I think that's one of the things that really distinguished them. And I've been talking about their kind of reluctance to enforce their will as a problem. But it's also the greatest thing about them because they really did show that it is possible to have these organizations without resorting to hierarchy and all of these other kind of things.
Do we have any sense of how the CNT operated in terms of efficiency and efficacy? Because there must have been, to some degree, a tension between not trying to coerce workers to do a certain thing, not imposing a certain division of labor, and getting the work done in an efficacious way.
Yeah. I mean, there's sort of pros and cons to that. I mean, on the con is that they were slower to respond to things, and they did take a lot longer. The pro is that when they did kind of make decisions, those were real decisions that were made all the way down, so that they were organized, and then they didn't have to like sort of second guess themselves. Once they had gone through these processes, you know, they were much firmer decisions because they had been done through all this consultation all the way down to the different affinity groups and so forth. There was a certain impatience, I think, with the way the CNT worked sometimes. So there was actually a secondary anarchist organization, the FAI, which was within the CNT, which was sort of to make sure that the CNT itself practiced strong anarchist principles. So there were kind of organic movements within the organization that kind of tried to like move things one way or the other. And of course, because they were anarchists, there was lots of divisions and lots of arguing.
James, can you possibly give us an example of a decision made by a large anarchist organization that features some of what you've been talking about?
Well, a very painful decision that they made that was never popular and I think probably spelled the end of anarchism in Spain ultimately was whether to join the Popular Front against fascism. Because the anarchists were in a position to sort of just take over and just run things themselves. But the Republican government, which was still the so-called legitimate government of Spain, insisted and kind of cajoled them and tricked them and begged them and everything else that they could do to not make that break and not declare themselves kind of stateless. And then sort of down the line from there, they kind of wanted them to join in this coalition with the communists and the liberals and, you know, everybody as a Popular Front united against the fascists. The more radical anarchists, and I was sort of on their side, did not want to do this, although some of them did change their mind. But some of them stayed true to never wanting to do that. They thought it was a terrible idea. And indeed, once they started joining the Popular Front just became a means by which to sort of attack and destroy anarchism and get rid of it, because the rest of them were all united on that.
And just getting back to this notion of individualism, you call it radical individualism that the anarchists espoused at the time. Yeah, I mean, that kind of puzzled me because I do kind of think of anarchists as advocating, you know, mutual aid, cooperation, working together. And that could be, of course, as part of an organization or some kind of collective. So to what degree did they stress individualism and individual liberty?
That's a great question. It's not an easy question to answer because there was strains within anarchism, some of whom sort of followed Max Stirner and really wanted just radical individualism, period. And then there was others who had a much more collectivist understanding. The anarchists that I'm most interested were not on the Stirner end of things, and they weren't just like individualism for individualism's sake. What they wanted to do was to make individualism as broad as possible within a collective context. So that, in other words, what I was talking about political equality before, as an individual, you get to express your political opinions and they matter and you get to have an active say in your political life. So that's a kind of way of expanding your individualism, but in a collective way. And I think that's a model for all these other kind of movements. Also with women, with the famous Mujeres Libres, which was an anarchist women's organization, they wanted to allow women to have their own individual lives within a collective anarchist context. And so that group worked with other groups to kind of expand the rights for women and their possibility of expressing their own voice and being full political participants with everybody else. That kind of thing is the model that I'm interested in.
James Martel joins us. He's professor of political science at San Francisco State University. We'll take a short break and speak more with James. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. James Martel, M-A-R-T-E-L, teaches political science at San Francisco State University. His research interests include political theory, continental philosophy, and theories of gender and sexuality. He's very interested in, among other things, early 20th century Spanish anarchism and radicalism as a way of life. And we are talking about an essay he wrote that he hopes to put into a book he eventually publishes. He has a book under contract called The Misinterpolated Subject. And you can read a book about the philosopher Walter Benjamin that James wrote. It's called Textual Conspiracies. We have a link to that book, as well as to a book called How Not to Be Governed, as well as to his faculty page at San Francisco State on our website, againstthegrain.org. So the anarchists then and now are anti-hierarchy, and yet, you know, we have a tendency to put people on a pedestal, don't we? And to look to exemplary figures and to worship heroes. And so part of your archival research into this period, which is the 1920s and 1930s in Spain, focuses on what the writers in these journals, what they thought about, what they expressed about the people they really looked up to. So who, for example, came up among the list of people that anarchists pointed to and said, you know, we ought to emulate them in some way?
Well, one of the great anarchist heroes is Buenaventura Durruti. He was a very radical anarchist, very much in favor of taking over and not sort of joining into the state or anything like that. So he was very, very far left. And he was, you know, worshipped by a lot of people in the anarchist movement in Catalonia and elsewhere. But what struck me when I was doing the archival research, especially when I compared it to the communist and socialist newspapers of the time, was the way that he was discussed as opposed to some of these sort of great communist heroes and figures, because they were always very careful not to kind of completely lionize him at the expense of the people. They'd always say that he was a great leader among many or the first among equals, and they always kind of even prided themselves. They would even say, and we don't think of him the way the communists think of their leaders. Like, they would actually say that explicitly as a way to sort of distinguish themselves. I couldn't always tell if that was propaganda or not, but I think at least part of it was genuine. And I think what was most interesting about it was that they would think about somebody like Durruti as a figure that would sort of inspire their own heroism, so that, his heroism was almost contagious and was a model. And again, it's another way to anarchize society to say no one is unique or special and that only that person could do those things. Each one of us has the ability to do these things. So if we look at one person like that, the point isn't to say, oh, he's so much better than the rest of us, we are so different from him, is rather to say, we are like him too, and we all could be like Durruti. So it is sort of to sort of decentralize his authority and his heroism and to sort of share it. And that was much more the spirit by which they kind of discussed these kind of people.
You're also interested in the way the Spanish anarchists viewed time. Tell us about this.
So that's another way in which they were very unique. One of the things that I looked at in my archival research was the way they treated May Day, which is a left-wing holiday in general, but the anarchists had their own particular reading of it. And what was interesting was they would celebrate a lot of things that didn't happen on May 1st, on May Day. Like, they celebrated or rather commemorated the assassination of Spies, who was one of the great German-American anarchists that they really loved, and the whole Haymarket affair and all that. They would celebrate those things on May 1st, even though they happened on different dates, because they felt like I sort of came to think of May 1st as a kind of floating signifier. It was sort of just about all these different moments in time that could all be kind of lumped together and put into one moment, so that they could sort of appreciate, again, how time itself isn't broken into these isolated and separate moments, but rather are all connected in this very intense and very political way, and which is, again, a very anarchist way to think about time.
Yeah, there seems to be some notion of flexibility, right? Flexibility in relation to time, in relation to practice, in relation to the way they characterize people around them. Again, is that maybe an example of not wanting something that's totalizing, that sums things up completely, that invades all spaces and times?
That's a great question. I think that's exactly the right question to ask, because it gets at the way that we're all secretly archists without realizing it. In other words, the very way we think about even what succeeds and what fails is archist. You know, one thing that we all assume is, well, anarchism failed in Spain. It's always going to fail. You know, there is no alternative, to quote Margaret Thatcher, right? I think that's a very archist way to think about things. If something happens and then it stops happening, that doesn't mean it failed. It means it was defeated. You know, it worked and then it was destroyed. you know, I think about the Black Panthers the same way. They didn't fail. They were destroyed by the police. So, you know, exactly. I think the measures of success that we use and the standards that we apply to political movements and other things in life as well are so unconsciously archaic that we expect, like I said, something to last forever because that's the way states are supposed to be, and something that's supposed to be, as I said earlier, continuous because that's the way things are supposed to be. One of the pleasures of reading this archival material was that we encountered this group of people who didn't think that way, and it's just showed me that you don't have to think that way. And the very way I found their way of thinking and acting strange was instructive to me about how much I myself was determined by these archaic way of thinking that I hadn't really understood before. And so it helped me to think less archaically myself. And that's sort of the hope that other people would similarly be affected.
And yet someone more cynical, say, than you or I might say, well, look, the episodic piecemeal nature of the Spanish anarchist experiment in the early 20th century reveals precisely that anarchism is not viable, given the absence of evidence that in the historical record since the 1920s that anarchism can kind of stick around in any significant way.
I guess, yes, to that cynical person, I would say a couple things. One is to tell a little story. I gave a version of this paper on a panel, and it was a funny panel because there was a right-wing person and a liberal and me. It was about economic and political equality. And the liberal person said, well, since liberal and political equality isn't actually possible, we have to make all these terrible compromises, blah, 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 blah. And then at what point I gave my paper and said to the liberal, actually, it is possible. It happened. So now you can't say that anymore. So now what do you say? And the person was, you know, it was one of those nice rare moments where somebody was kind of speechless. And so that's one point I would say to the cynical person. I would say it has happened. It has worked. It has existed. You cannot rule it out of existence by fiat, which is, of course, what archists would do. And you have to contend with that. And the second thing I would say is, and this is, you know, a very important point, is insofar as our current period does seem to me to be extremely anarchist in terms of the response to capitalism and globalization and neoliberalism and all that, you can't even say that it's been ineffective. I think that each moment of these so-called failures sort of amps up this possibility that cannot be taken away. And this is a moment where you're really seeing that happening, that people are, you know, being influenced by long ago times in a very direct and actual way. And so, like, that's what Alain Badiou said, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. Once something is possible, it's never impossible again.
What do you make of the sense of the anarchist emphasis on practice and everyday life and implementation and on the ground cooperation, in the sense of the rich, the possible richness or not maybe of anarchist theory, of intellectual theory relating to anarchism? I mean, a lot of people read the kind of iconic anarchist thinkers like Bakunin and Kropotkin and say, well, you know, it's really not that systematic. And so, you know, on a theoretical level, anarchism really isn't that interesting or compelling. It's really, you just really have to look at what's happening on the ground.
My favorite saying about anarchism is by a great anarchist scholar, Kathy Ferguson, who wrote, everyone says that anarchism is great in theory but bad in practice, but it's actually the exact opposite. It's not a very good theory, but it's a wonderful practice. And I think that's exactly right. I mean, I love Bakunin and Kropotkin too, and I think they're wonderful books. That they write wonderful books. But I think that everything that anarchism has given to the world has come from the practices. And this is another reason why I was kind of reluctant to go in a very highly theoretical angle here and just stay much more rooted in practices and experiences, because I think that's where anarchism has its greatest strength. You can't know what's going to work until you try it and see if it works. And anarchism is a very practical, hands-on kind of system. It's almost anti-theoretical in that sense. Although I think the theory, you need the theory in some ways to guide it and inspire it. I think it comes down to brass tacks in a way that's much more critical than in many other movements, which are much more reliant on these kind of ideological and theoretical models.
But as a political theorist, I mean, you like to work with ideas, you like to grapple with them. Isn't that a little frustrating that, you know, your affinity is towards something that suits practice a lot more than theorizing?
Actually, I find that very exciting. I mean, I've always felt a reluctance as a theorist to kind of speak from the mountaintop down to the masses and tell them what they think and what's true. I think it much more exciting, and this is, I guess, the anarchist in me, to have it work the other way and to actually learn from people and to be changed and altered by experiences. So I think that political theorists should be open to that kind of experience. Otherwise, you're just making stuff up. You have to be rooted in experience and practice. So I think it's healthy and wonderful to kind of be overtaken by anarchist practices as much as that's possible.
James Martell joins us. He's professor of political science at San Francisco State University. Well, if anarchism is rooted in everyday experience, then the nature of experience is important, right? And we have to acknowledge that in this day and age, and certainly back in the 1920s and 30s, experience is colored by, it's immersed in ideology, right? That we have mainstream, we have hegemonic ideologies affecting our everyday experiences in ways that we're not even necessarily conscious of. So how do we deal with that? How does an anarchist get to and rely so much on experience at the same time as experience is so colored by what is very clearly non-anarchist ideological tendencies?
That's an excellent question. I think that our experiences always, just as you said, are always overshadowed by certain ideological positions, so that we actually change the way we experience, if that makes sense, based on these belief systems and these values and these judgments that we have, you know. And I think what's interesting is that, you know, I was talking about the anarchism of everyday life, that we have these anarchist moments, but our ideology doesn't allow us to see that as anarchism or to see it as a political practice. Like a lot of things that we do that aren't determined by states and governments and all that kind of stuff, we just sort of think as not – we don't even think at all. Maybe we don't think of them as political at all. You know, so there's ways in which we don't recognize the experiences that we do have because of our subservience to these kind of normative anarchist principles. And so – this is exactly why I wanted to do this project and why I have loved doing the project so much, was because the very sense of the alien and the strange nature of the way the anarchists in Spain in the 20s and 30s thought speaks to the way I override my own experience at this time and think about what is properly political and what isn't, what is possible and what isn't. So it's exactly what Walter Benjamin said. It's the encounter with a different way of thinking with an earlier era that actually kind of splits apart this era and the way that it is formed, so that you can kind of rescue experience from the mouth of sovereign determination, I guess is a way. And then you can sort of revisit your own experiences and the arc of history in a way, telling a very, very different story.
So I'm interested in how you would evaluate, let's say, Black Lives Matter and let's say Occupy Wall Street. Let's take those two movements. From an anarchist perspective, what do you see in them that you like and maybe that you dislike, and what lessons that we might take from the Spanish anarchists of the 1920s and 30s? What lessons might people in these movements and supporters of these movements apply and use?
Well, you know, I think the first thing to say is that Occupy Wall Street was kind of, I think, pretty consciously anarchist. I don't think you can say the same of Black Lives Matter, but I think of them both as sort of anarchist expressions of sort of self-organization on the part of various communities that wanted to change something. I think the critical issue that both of those movements encountered, and I'm starting to fear that they both might have the same trajectory on this, is the refusal to make demands. Because I think once you start making demands, you're negotiating with the state. And therefore, you are trying to sort of accommodate yourself to the state in some way and find a way to live with the state. And that's sort of, to me, the antithesis of anarchism. Once you start making a list of demands, then let's say the state gives you your demands, then that's it. Then you go away, right? I think Black Lives Matter is not just a list of demands. It's a kind of a fundamental calling into question of the, you know, the racist policies of the United States and its police force. That's not really a demand. That's just kind of a rejection of a systematic institutionalized racism. Similar with Occupy Wall Street, you know, I remember for a long time, people were like, oh, they don't even have a list of demands. What's wrong with them? They're just a bunch of like weirdos in their tents and so on. And then when they did start to, you know, some of them had demands, some of them didn't. But when they started coming up with lists of demands, it sort of weakened them and say, oh, that's all you want. You know, then, oh, we can work that out. You know, so I think to me, any properly anarchist movement, and this happened in Spain too, has no demands. It's just a big no. It's just saying no to the whole thing, no to the state, no to the police, no to all of it. And I think that non-negotiating principle is really critical.
But saying no and at the same time projecting or offering an alternative, right?
Exactly. And the alternative is actually, once again, present in the methods by which these movements organize themselves. So, I mean, that is the political alternative right there. So both Black Lives Matter and, you know, Occupy Wall Street have, I think, brilliant organizational principles that work very, very well. And they're both masterful at it. So that's already giving proof to the lie that anarchist movements and principles can't work or are impossible without massive hierarchies and so on and so forth.
But for example, with Black Lives Matter, if you want to eliminate institutional racism, then you really do want the system to change. I mean, you are demanding that the system, which you are then looking up to or looking at, you want it to change. So in some ways, you still are appealing to the state and to larger structures to make your lives better, to treat you in a certain way, to regard you in a different way, and to banish, ideally, all these practices that are brutalizing, for example, people who are Black.
Yeah, I think, though, I mean, I'm sure this conversation is happening in Black Lives Matter all the time, but I think the problem is the system is not going to change. The system is racist to the core, rotten, rotten, rotten to the core, and there's no change to be had. So I think as the leadership or the – just not the leadership, but just the entirety of Black Lives Matter sort of encounters that, there's not going to be any request for change. There's going to be it will be a demand for a much deeper change, which is like a kind of an absolute elimination of the system entirely, because that's the problem. It's not like the police are going to stop killing Black people all of a sudden. I mean, that's just part of how this country operates, and it's kind of almost required for the system to keep doing that.
So most of our interview today is focused on this paper that you shared with me. It's called What Equality Actually Looks Like: Lessons from Anarchist Spain on Equality, Temporality, and the Art of the Possible. What are your plans with this paper and this research project?
I'm hoping to turn this into a book so that the various aspects that we've talked about today, the organizational principles and the way they dealt with heroes and the way they thought about space and time, all of those would kind of be chapters of a larger book. But basically, the ideas that I've sort of brought to you here today are sort of the basis for that book.
You just got a book under contract, I think, from Duke University Press. It's called, or the title you would like it to have, is The Misinterpolated Subject. What does that mean?
So that's a project that's sort of it's very different in that it's much more theoretical than this project about the Spanish anarchists. But the idea is the same, which is to sort of expand the way we think about anarchism in all possible directions. And this book is particularly about anarchizing the subject, the individual that we are. There's a theory called interpolation theory. The main theorist is Louis Althusser. And the idea is that we get our identity, even our most basic personal identity, from the state, from being interpolated, being called by the state. His famous example is somebody walking down the street and a police officer says, "Hey, you there." And the person turns around, and Althusser says, by that 180-degree turn, that person becomes a subject. So that's kind of what we're dealing with, the kind of false archaic subjectivities that we all think is us. And that, by the way, is the us that's shaping and determining our experience in archaic ways and keeping us on a long archaic path. So the idea of misinterpolation is what happens when the call goes wrong or something goes awry or somehow that doesn't work out. The wrong person is called or the wrong person is interpolated. And just to sort of think more about the subject itself as anarchist. So not just that we're anarchists together in our collectivity, but as an individual self, I myself am anarchist. Like, there's not one organizing part of me that determines the rest, that all parts of me have to be in on this and have to be involved. That we're multiply determined, but we're heteronomous beings. All that kind of stuff that usually gets left out from liberal ways of thinking about the self is what I'd like to explore in that book.
And can you share kind of the main thesis, the main argument you're making?
Well, the big thinker behind that book is Nietzsche. And the idea there is that for Nietzsche, we're constantly we actually hate ourselves very passionately because none of us are ever what the state or liberalism or whatever you want to call it promises us that we are. So our self-hatred it makes us very, very susceptible to these kind of interpolations of these kind of other identities. Like, I don't want to be this. I'd rather be whatever you tell me to be, right? And so what's beautiful about Nietzsche is he sort of looks kindly at this hated self that we are and kind of seeks it to sort of come out from under the shadow of interpolated subjectivity and sort of express itself. And it's beautiful, it's complicated, it's ugly, it's all of those things, but it's exactly the person none of us want to be but are.
James Martell, professor of political science at San Francisco State University. Again, we have on our website againstthegrain.org a link to his faculty page there, to his book Textual Conspiracies about Walter Benjamin, and to the co-edited book How Not to Be Governed, Readings and Interpretations from a Critical Anarchist Left. James, a pleasure talking with you today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Kimberly Schreiber co-produced today's program. And this is CS suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.